To our Wednesday, February 20th meeting of the Joint Committee on the Oregon State Hospital Patient Care. And first let me say that we have several members of the committee that are serving on the Ways and Means Committee. The Ways and Means Committee is voting on some extremely important budget bills down the hall, so Senator Jackie Winters told me to send her regrets. I know that Vice Chair Bruce Hanna will be along shortly, and so will several other of our members. So please don't take it as a lack of interest on their part, because everybody is extremely engaged and interested in hearing the testimony. Tonight we will be hearing from first representatives from the state hospital, and that will happen during the first hour. We're going to ask members of the committee to hold their questions during this presentation so that we can have the presenters get through what will be, I think, a very informative presentation of the crosswalk document, which represents the hospital's plan for dealing with many of the problems that have been pointed out in the Department of Justice. Then in the second hour, as you'll see on the agenda, we will be hearing from several different groups of people who have perspectives on what is going on at the state hospital. That'll include the people that work there, people who advocate for patients, people who have been patients there. And likewise, we will try to let them talk, and then we will ask them questions as time allows. So, without further ado, Mr. President, did you have any comments
to make,
or shall we just start?
Sorry.
Okay, I will call Nancy Franz Geddes, the Oregon State Hospital Director of Nursing Services, and with her will please come forward John Bischoff and Arthur Tolan. Welcome to our committee. Thanks for being here this evening. And members, you are being distributed a document which has been prepared for this presentation, so I think that what we'll be hearing from you will be following some of what we're looking at. Great. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Franz Geddes. I am the Director of Nursing Services at Oregon State Hospital.
Hi. Thank you, Co-Chairs and members of the committee. I'm John Bischoff. I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University, and I work at the Oregon State Hospital as the chief psychiatrist.
Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Tolan. I'm the director of clinical services for Oregon State Hospital.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm going to give a little start off because I probably have the largest historical perspective of the hospital. And I want to start off by just saying to you that I believe in the work that we do. I believe that our work has positive impact on patient lives. I believe that we can and that we must improve. I also believe that our employees have the talent and dedication to make the changes that we must make. So I just want to start by saying that and by telling you that the hospital has afforded me a career of opportunity and services, both as a staff nurse for a year, a supervising nurse for 9 years, a nursing educator, a unit director, and now the director of nursing services at the hospital. I thought it might be helpful for you to get sort of a practical overview of what the hospital is. And just briefly to tell you that our hospital has 22 units. We have 4 units in Portland that have civil patients. We have 14 or 18 units in Salem. 4 of those are geriatric and medical units, and 14 of them are forensic services, and we serve people with 370 that are being admitted to the hospital, and we serve maximum security, medium security, and minimum security patients at the hospital. We have about 700 nursing staff. And I think it's important to know that when I say nursing staff, that means RNs, LPNs, and CNAs, which also are called mental health therapists. And we have about 200 RNs, about 30 LPNs, and about 450 CNAs at the hospital. Additionally, for direct care services, we have psychologists, social workers, master's prepared mental health specialists. We have OT, occupational therapists, recreational therapists, music therapists. So all together, we probably have approximately 900 staff that provide direct care, patient care services at the hospital. I think that that's probably a good overview. I do have a document to help sort of walk you through nurse staffing. We can do that now, or we can do that when we get to staffing, whichever you would like.
I think we'd like you to keep going with your presentation.
Okay, and then fabulous. So you all have this in your packet, and I don't mean this to be condescending in any way, but I think that for most folks that don't work in a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week facility, it's difficult to understand staffing numbers because those numbers seem huge. 700 nursing staff for 700 patients seems like a one-on-one. So I wanted to just step the group quickly through what it takes to staff a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week. So what I have is the Sunday through Saturday schedule, and an understanding that contractually RNs, for example, have to be given either weekends off, split days with every other weekend. So to cover 7 days a week, three shifts, we need six nurses. And that is essentially like one FTE that would do a person's work. So in order to cover a unit, we have to have those six nurses, two on days, two on swing, and two on nights. And that covers the 7 day a week. And as you can see, we accumulate some in the middle of the week, which then we can distribute. But just to let you know that when you ask around the 17 RN positions, that it does take a lot of positions in order to just cover a single unit's 1 week, 24-hour-a-day staffing. So that's just a little breakdown of staffing. We have a document for you to go over the crosswalk.
Right, co-chairs and members of the committee. We have created a sort of a high-level summary of the detailed crosswalk that was presented to you two weeks ago. And each one of us will be leading you through sort of that high-level summary. And then when we're finished, we'll be happy to take your questions about the details. So the serious findings from the U.S. Department of Justice's letter regarding protection from harm included patient and staff assault, self-injurious behaviors by patients, and high rate of falls. It also documented environmental hazards in housing units and inadequate incident management and quality assurance systems. So we have provided some detail in the detailed crosswalk about some of the accomplishments, the actions that the hospital's taken already, much of which actually happened well before the arrival of the findings letter, including educating all the staff on behavioral management and communication skills. This takes the form of orientation training and annual training for all staff around these behavior management and communication skills. Expanded falls reduction program hospital-wide. That was after a pilot program. It's now been expanded hospital-wide to reduce falls. We've also established and implemented guidelines for intensive patient monitoring. Revised and implemented dangerousness risk assessment hospital-wide. This will be a really key issue in terms of providing better protection from harm. We've trained all staff in asbestos awareness, safe equipment operation, and use of personal protective equipment. We've created electronic critical incident and medication error reporting and follow-up system, and we can provide you with more details about that critical incident reporting system during the question and answer. So even with all that framework, groundwork already established, we have ambitious goals set for ourselves, and you probably saw in the detailed crosswalk and some of the other documents we've provided you, we've set short-term and intermediate benchmarks for ourselves toward these ambitious goals of reducing all patient and staff assault to zero, having a zero tolerance for any assault or injury of patients and staff while at the hospital or working at the hospital, and preventing self-injury and falls. It's our goal imminently to relocate all patients currently residing in at-risk buildings, and ultimately, of course, to have our patients move into a new facility that would minimize, if not eliminate, all risk. And then also, this is crucial, using the data that we're collecting and also involving all levels of leadership and management in improving patient and staff safety in real time. And what we mean by that is actually responding to critical incidents and more serious incidents in real time, and debriefing and reviewing those incidents to change current patient care for a particular patient, and then also make recommendations regarding changes in programs or hospital-wide care that would provide for better protection from harm. So.
And when you say responding in real time, what does that mean?
Well, we would define a level of seriousness of incident that would require 24/7 response from hospital management and leadership to actually respond and go to the situation that involved patient and or staff and review it, debrief it in real time, and then outline a process of more comprehensive review, altering the patient's treatment care plan and or making policy alterations for that unit or for the hospital generally. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, before I go into the next section, I would like just to state that I am very honored and proud to be part of the Oregon State Hospital team and management team and leadership team, as well as work with many professionals that are highly dedicated in providing quality care to our patients. Prior to joining the Oregon State Hospital, actually I came back to the hospital after a short detour of 11 years with Department of Corrections, where I was the administrator for mental health services and addiction services. As I mentioned, I'm returning to Oregon State Hospital, being glad to join a team that is really dedicated to provide better care to our patients. The CRIPA report is one report that we very seriously look at, all the findings that they addressed, especially in this area of mental health care. And I'd like just to give you a brief context for every patient that comes into the hospital. In order to be able to provide a level of care and treatment modalities, you have to be able to assess what the needs are, what the specifics of that individual is, be able to formulate a diagnosis that will reflect those needs, as well as based on the diagnosis develop a treatment care plan that then will identify treatment modalities by which we can alleviate some of the risk factors that are identified. All this is done with the purpose of focusing towards discharge, enhancing individuals' capabilities to return to their communities. The CRIPA report found that in these areas of assessment, diagnosis, treatment care plannings, there are some deficiencies, major deficiencies that we need to focus on. And our goal is again to integrate all these elements of assessment, diagnosis, treatment care planning, so we can increase patients' ability to be discharged. So what have we done in the meantime to move towards these goals? As you will see, some of the things that we already implemented have been like to improve the interdisciplinary risk assessment. So we created a team led by a clinical psychologist that works with every treatment team to identify those risk factors for each specific individual housed in the hospital at this time and how to integrate that into a treatment plan. For every high-risk case that is identified, people that have difficult behaviors, people that are hard to maintain because of frequent reoccurrence of high-level behaviors, we provided interdisciplinary consultation. So we have a team of clinicians that go around and meet with every specific treatment team to address those needs in one with the idea to better diagnose or clarify diagnosis or to better formulate a treatment care plan that will allow for us to move that individual to a lower level of care or a less restrictive environment. Another step we took was to improve the behavior support plans. And we have a group that is working on behavior support plans and already formulated a plan. We are ready to roll the plan out and start training every treatment team in how to develop those behavior support plans. Dr. Bishop can address the next two items here that are more specific to his area. Enhanced physician.
Yeah. And right. Co-chairs, members of the committee, we have enhanced our physician peer review for assessment, diagnosis, and prescribing. This takes the form of a monthly meeting of physicians who do quality assurance checks on charts of their peers. They review the assessments for completeness. They review diagnoses for accuracy, and they have initiated review of prescribing practices, including issues such as polypharmacy, prescribing too many patients to one, too many medications to one patient at the same time. Also, the hospital, in compliance with Joint Commission standards, and has implemented a medication accuracy and error review system. It's technically called medication reconciliation, and it's a detailed way in which medications are checked on admission, on transfer, in and out of the hospital or between units, and on discharge to ensure that they're accurately prescribed. And then our error review system has to do with, you may see the term medication variance, and that's reviewing those variances or those errors and providing follow-up on serious incidents. So,
co-chairs and members of the committee, I'd like to go back to one of the goals that we are looking at implementing, and we have taken some steps towards, was to implement 20 hours of centralized services, treatment services for all patients. Why is that important? But we think that once patients are involved in treatment and are busy during the day, probably that will have an impact on the frequency of incidents that occur, of behaviors that are directed towards other patients or staff, by keeping them active and by addressing specifically those treatment areas that have been identified as risk factors that preclude them at this time from being discharged in the community. At the Portland campus, we already have implemented the centralized treatment services. Also, you will hear that referred as treatment mall, and we're planning to move forward with centralized services also at the Salem campus starting in August.
So in the area of seclusion and restraint, the CRIPA report also, again, very serious findings that OSH uses seclusion and restraint excessively and inappropriately. Planned seclusion or programmed seclusion was an example of this. It also found that there was inadequate monitoring of secluded and or restrained patients. I think it's important to acknowledge that all of our efforts that we've already undertaken and that we will undertake to deal with improvement of mental health care generally, of our protection from harm efforts, of staffing, the nursing care issues that Nancy Franzgattis will talk to you about, all of those will result, hopefully, in a reduction in the use of seclusion and restraint. Setting out to reduce the use of seclusion and restraint primarily is not recommended by most contemporary standards. You must have in place all the rest of your improvement efforts, good mental health care, and then this as an indicator will seclusion and restraint will decrease. So the actions that we've taken already are, again, we've trained staff in crisis communication and the use of least restrictive safe interventions. That's the orientation and annual training that I mentioned previously. We have at this time eliminated all use of program plan seclusion and or restraint, we are also providing constant individual monitoring for all seclusion or restraint patients. This is something that's written in the OSH seclusion and restraint policy, that whenever a person is initiated on a seclusion or restraint order, they are continuously, individually, visually observed. So our goals, though, with all that in mind, are to implement a hospital-wide restraint reduction initiative, primarily through nursing services, and also to reduce to a minimum, as is clinically safe and appropriate, right, and ensure that we are appropriately using seclusion and restraint when we do. So, and we can say more about that and answer your questions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, in nursing care, we were found to have insufficient numbers of nursing staff, which results in inadequate treatment, and that was in a variety of areas, and that there was no formal system to analyze specific unit staffing numbers or skill mix. And I would say to you that we still do staffing in a paper and pencil sort of way. So it is very challenging to do centralized staffing when you have it done basically on schedules that are rather like calendars. So we definitely have some ways to go with this. Actions, we have received approval for 17 registered nurse positions, which is significant and important. And those 17 positions will be placed in the forensics treatment area of the hospital, which is some of our higher use and needs for nursing in the hospital, including two of the positions that will be associated with the treatment model, so we can get to centralized treatment services, which I do believe is incredibly important to give patients opportunities to get off the unit, to have meaningful experiences, to feel hopeful about their care and treatment, which they may not get on a unit with a census of 42. So having centralized treatment services is very, very valuable. We have received consultation on national nurse staffing standards for psychiatric nursing, and I believe you've received some of that information in previous documents with a calculation called hour per patient day, which is sort of a staff to patient ratio, if you will. And the national standards are 5.0 and 5.5 hours per patient day with a 30% RN component related to that staffing. And I've made those projections in the documents regarding staffing for the new hospital. We also have, Bob Nickel has chaired the Psychiatric Nursing Workforce Development Group, which was a consortium of folks from across the state, both in education and in facilities and throughout the DHS, to be able to address psychiatric nursing shortages, which, as you can imagine, is quite significant. The nursing shortage in and of itself is significant, but less than 1 in 10 graduating nurses have psychiatric or behavioral health as an area of interest. So that's one of the things that we will want to continue working on. We did revise and implement a comprehensive nursing assessment on admission, and I would the nursing staff have been most excellent in this. I think what's important, the success stories to know, is that even though our staffing is incredibly short, our nurses do phenomenal work given the resources they have, and currently our rate for compliance with a four-hour comprehensive nursing assessment is 99%. So that's pretty impressive, and we have, within that comprehensive nursing assessment, we address all kinds of psychiatric issues, fall issues, risk issues. We address patients' needs, their preferences, and it's just important for the group to know that even though we have nursing shortages, we still are able to come almost to 100% on nursing assessments. Also, we revised nursing pharmacy procedures related to specifically the night pharmacy, which is where nurses have to go off shift. The pharmacy, our pharmacy services right now are business-oriented. They're Monday through Friday, essentially 8 to 5. And off-hour services, nurses literally have to access the pharmacy by getting a key and going into the pharmacy. Salem campus, we also have pharmacy lockboxes in Portland campus. But so we revised procedures to make sure that that was safe and adequate. And for infection control, we have hired a full-time nurse epidemiologist and have a hand hygiene campaign, and unfortunately I didn't bring the posters, but we have some pretty amazing posters that we took of patients or staff throughout the facility that actually are washing their hands and just using that sort of as a motivational tool. Our goals related to nurse staffing is to make sure that we obtain funding to recruit and retain staff members in adequate numbers to meet those national standards. And some of those numbers are going to be quite challenging to gather for the facility. And we would also like to implement centralized nurse staffing with automated scheduling. And that is a bottom line need in order, and I have to say, creating documents for this committee and others when we have to sift through things by hand and do hours of this work, it just really makes me motivated to want to try to convince folks that we do need an automated staffing program for the hospital and that centralized services for staffing would be of huge benefit for the treatment units and for the staff themselves.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, in the area of discharge planning, I mentioned before when we talked about, I talked about treatment planning, that one of the goals of identifying good treatment plans and being able to design good treatment modalities is that of moving towards discharge with our patients. The CRIPA report is very clear that we have not done a good job, adequate job in providing that continuity of care and providing the adequate treatment that will tool with our patients and our consumers with those skills that they need to move forward in the community. So we are looking at redoing the system of treatment planning, and we are looking actually as our goal is to implement a new approach, which is the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, treatment care planning. This is a more holistic approach. You're looking at the individual as a whole. You're addressing psychiatric needs, you're addressing medical needs, you're addressing emotional needs, social needs, the support system. And we will start a pilot project in one of the units to implement this wellness recovery action plan in March the 3rd, and then we're ready to implement it hospital-wide July 1st of this year. It is very important for us to be able to include the consumer, the patient, into developing such a recovery plan. Therefore, our plan will be really patient-centered to address those needs. When it comes to community transition, the community wants to be reassured that the folks that re-enter that community have the skills to survive there. Therefore, through assessment, we're going to look at strength. Through the treatment care planning, we're going to look at what risk factors we need to be addressed and mitigate. And then one step to move closer to provide the continuity of care was to identify a team of community transition social workers that are the liaison between the hospital and the community. They provide the outreach and the contact with community providers to ensure that the transition is seamless between hospital level of care and the community level of care. Thank you very much.
So that concludes your presentation. Well, thank you very much for keeping within the time limit that we set for you. And I'm sure we have more questions than we'll have time for, but we'll try to take as many of them as possible. And I'll start with Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have lots of questions, so you stop me when you need to. I'm not sure who was mentioned on the second page. Provide all patients with centralized 20 hours a week of active recovery-focused care. I'm assuming that's not individual therapy. Are you talking about group therapy? What are you talking about there?
co-chairs, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. We're talking about 20 hours of centralized services group treatment. And actually, one of the questions is what represents active treatment as opposed to just recreational or activities or some leisure type activities. Any time we identify as an area where people lack certain skills, and that area is included on the treatment care planning, all the modalities that address that will be considered as active care of treatment. For example, ground walks, people walking on the ground, or watching television. If one of the skills that people lack in order to reintegrate in the community is that of being able to socialize with others, being able to be in a group of patients, then those ground walks will be included as an activity with a smaller group. All the other
would be called therapy.
That will be included as part of the modality for active care, because they will have a staff with them. They can practice the skills. They can practice what are risk factors that come up during their walk. For example, what are triggers that may make me just take off, and they will practice those skills.
And may I have
how about two more questions, and then we'll go to somebody else.
Okay, I'm going to think about which two I want to. Okay, so that's not going to start until August, and if so, why is that put off until that far away?
To expand it, co-chairs and members of the committee.
You know, how about if we dispense with that protocol? I think it takes up time, and we'd rather hear your answers.
Thank you. We have implemented already that at the Portland campus. In order to implement it at the Salem campus, when we have more patients and really high numbers of patients, we have to reallocate staff, and we have to have the proper space, environment to do that centralized services. What centralized services mean, patients will live on units, and that will be their home, and they will go through services to meet the clinicians and the providers almost like in an outpatient model. We have to be able to create that kind of space where they will come in, and we can use, we can better utilize the number of staff that will be available to deliver the group treatment. So we are in the process of identifying the plans where we can deliver that type of care and what kind of staff we can allocate for these services.
Thank you. My last one is directed to you. I'm not sure what you mean by admission nursing assessment. When you talk about 5 hours and 4 hours, I have no idea what you're talking about.
The 5 hours and 4 hours. Oh, our all patients that come to the hospital get assessments by a variety of disciplines. Nursing does an assessment, psychology, social work, the psychiatrist. So the nursing assessment is a comprehensive assessment. It's 9 pages. And it's done within the first 4 hours of admission.
I see. Great. Thank you so much. Thank
you,
Madam Chair.
And Senator Carter. Do you want me to go to Representative Berger and come back
to you?
Representative Berger.
I really appreciate the steps you've taken. And I read through the crosswalk document, and I liked the format of it. And what you've just given us is sort of an overview, a flyover of what's in here. So I want to dive down into this a little bit. And my questions aren't specific on anything. My comment to you is that from up here, we hear your words, and we know you're good people. But where are the things we can measure progress towards goal? And I think they're embedded in here, but I guess for me, I need a little more metrics on going forward from here. I looked at this. I don't live your lives. I don't go out and interact with patients. And when you talk about an incident report, a measurement is the risk management department follow-up forms and tracking database and consistent investigation. I don't know how to measure whether that happened at the end of this. So I guess I'm asking you as an overview of what you're doing here, that you also look to providing me at least with some way to measure. A little better measurement things. Your incident report thing is a critical thing. I don't even know what it looks like. Bring me a sample, I guess, and show me how this is going to help you be the tool, and then I guess that's what I'm looking for here. If, does that help you? I maybe not articulated it very well, but from up here, I need a measurement, not just your words, because I believe you. But how do I translate that into sort of measurable steps that I can measure?
Sure.
Did you want to respond to that? Or?
Sure. I appreciate your comments. And I think it's important, again, to recognize that the hospital is at a very normal stage of organizational development. Remembering that only 3 years ago or so, the hospital got personal computers, with which many of the departments have been gathering a lot of data. And so the hospital is moving from a sort of a transactional sort of mode of data collection, where they're sort of counting things and looking at, you know, what actually happens, to using those numbers to actually inform improvement efforts. And so that data, moving beyond just data gathering to data analysis, data integration, and using the data to feedback improvement efforts is where we are right now. So absolutely, and the great thing about this document and the other document related to it, which was the high-level measures in each of the five areas of the report, the CRIPA report, we've defined at least two, in some areas three, high-level measures that will actually form sort of the basis of a publicly posted dashboard, if you will, and maybe you've heard that term before, but these will be our highest level indicators of improvement success. So I think that you're making a great overall case. And then the specific question about incident reporting, I'd be happy to provide you with the actual levels. There are four levels now defined of incident reporting, and there's defined and required follow-up in each of the three highest levels. The minor level is more resolved on a local basis, but there's leadership involvement, and then those data will be collected and analyzed, integrated, trended. We'll look at trends around certain categories of incidents and certain severity of incident, and that will help us target our improvement efforts further.
If I can follow up, because I'm not saying just go out and measure everything, and that, you know, I'm just saying that I think one of the hearts of the CRIPA criticism was you don't know what you're doing, you know, or you can't tell us. It's something you may be doing it, but we can't find it in some. And at the end, I don't think we just want a whole bunch of pieces of paper, but we want that final piece, which is, here's what we've collected, here's what it tells us, and here's what it tells us we need to do, and that's where we want to get, and I'm kind of looking to walk that journey as a committee with you.
Thank you.
Senator Carter.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I was starving, Madam Chair. I've been in committee since 2 o'clock, so I'm starving.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Doctor, when you talked about the issue around discharge planning, outreach and discharge, your action coordination by OSH Community Transition Social Workers, I want to first of all compliment you. I think that's a great idea because the people can reach out into the community and can talk. But what I want to know is when we looked at the plan, and then talk about how sometimes people could sit there for a long period of time without being discharged and basically held there, what would be a strategy that you would use around dealing with that issue about the discharge?
Madam Chair, this issue of discharge planning is a complex one because, as we all understand it, we are treating folks, we are preparing them to get ready for discharge, but also that implies that the community is ready to absorb these individuals back into the community. So we're looking at working with AMH and DHS at that level of better coordinating the development of placements for these individuals in the community. But also our role would be really in the hospital to better identify the specific needs that will help individuals individuals reintegrate in the community. Better use peer support, better use patient-centered kind of recovery model. And once we're able to address specifically those risk factors that right now, let's say somebody really has a high substance abuse issue, and that precludes the individual to return, to be accepted back into a group home or a facility. We need to address those issues, and that's what the Wellness Recovery Action Plan is doing, specifically addressing the needs to enhance a person's ability to be accepted back into the community. And then the other part is developing appropriate placements in the community to be able to take individuals that have higher needs.
Okay. Madam Chair, just a comment along the lines in the short period of time I've been here as well. I think it is so creative to have pictures of staff people who are working right in the hospital showing their hands being washed as opposed to some picture of somebody up there, you know, but just actually showing your staff. I think it's great. That's very creative. But the other thing I want to say, Madam Chair, is that we didn't get where we are overnight. And I hear this committee that people are impatient and they want to see change right now. I want to see that too. But it took a period of time for us to disengage resources at the hospital and short-staffed and everything else for people that were there. And so I am saying that all of us as a team have to be patient here. Yes, let's be critical and let's have great expectation, but let's have some patience in terms of the kind of job that all of us have to do as a state at the hospital, because every time we point at somebody else, we are pointing back at ourselves as the body who's supposed to be managing this process. So I'm going to have great expectations for you guys. I'm going to probably be critical, but I want you to know that this is a partnership, and I'm looking forward to us going forward and getting some positive things done to clear up this report and the good people that are working at this hospital be given the kind of support that they need as well.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Senator Courtney.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think what I'd like to do is I'll just define myself each one of these categories, and then I'll stop to see if others want to ask questions, because I have a variety of questions. Is that all right, Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you for your document that tracks the report. It's very helpful. And under protection from harm, it says environmental hazards in housing units. There's findings of that. And then you go down excuse me, say that you've trained all staff in asbestos awareness. Have they all been trained now? It says trained, your actions trained all staff in asbestos awareness. Have you trained them all?
The staff receive training regarding asbestos awareness as part of their annual education day.
Is that the only environmental hazard there is? That this finding refers to environmental hazards in housing units. Is that the only environmental hazard there is asbestos?
You may be thinking of...
I'm not thinking of anything. Well, I'm just asking, is the word speak to, I'm asking what that means. Is it only asbestos, or there are environmental hazards out there, since you focused on asbestos and you said environmental hazards? That's all I'm asking. I'm not trying to go anywhere. I'm just asking for clarification for my edification.
There are other environmental hazards on the units. There are safety committees on every unit that are comprised of staff who work on that unit. There is also an environment of care committee, and those two entities are charged with reviewing clinical care environments.
Okay, tell me what the environmental hazards are if it's not asbestos.
Pardon me?
Name the environmental hazards if it's not asbestos. I'm trying to get a picture what it's like to be a patient out there and or an employee. That's the picture I've been trying to get at the state hospital. So help me. There's environmental hazards at these housing units. Asbestos is one of them. Tell me the other ones. If you don't know, that's fine.
Body fluids would be another environmental hazard, right?
Body fluids?
Body fluids.
Would that be an environmental hazard?
That could be in your environment if, let's say, somebody draws blood and there is blood on the floor or dripping, or there is fecal material.
That's an environmental hazard?
It's in your environment of care, patient care.
Okay, that's a different... Thank you. I would never have thought that as environmental hazard in terms of my background, but I don't have your background, so thank you for that. Reduce patient and staff assaults to zero. It's gold. What is the percentage now? Or is it zero?
Well, I can answer that, Senator. Currently, and we have data. Actually, it's in the detailed crosswalk. The number of patient to staff injuries or patient to staff incidents and patient on patient assaults as well. It's in the detailed crosswalk. I don't have the numbers right here in front of me.
Still pretty high.
It's actually a number that is not acceptable to us. It's
like how many last week? How many today? I mean, how many on a daily basis can I have? What do you average on a daily basis out there? Can you quantify it like that?
Yeah, I don't have those data, but I certainly can get them for you.
Okay. The next statement, relocate all patients currently residing in at-risk buildings. That's a dynamite statement to me. How many buildings out there are included in that statement?
It's my understanding that currently there's one building, the 41 building, that's considered to be the highest priority risk due to seismic considerations.
So how many patients are in that building?
Approximately 70.
Okay, you're going to relocate them where?
You want to speak to that?
I don't think that the hospital has crafted quite a plan yet as to where those patients would go. Clearly, we would have to either absorb them into other units. We have looked at in the new hospital construction plan some of the on-grounds cottages being able to be accelerated in their remodeling so we could take, because those folks in the 41 are transitional patients, residential level of care, that perhaps we could move folks from that building into on-ground cottages instead of being in that building.
And the 41 building is on the north side, right, as opposed to the J building on the south. Am I right or am I wrong? I got this confused.
It's the building that has a cupola on it. So it is the building that is on the south side.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most historical. It's
part the
of
J.
The J.
Yes. Thank you. Can I just ask, then I'll be still. I can
yes, please.
So when you say at risk, I want to be sure, you only mean seismic. That's the only thing you meant by that statement. There's nothing else that makes it an at-risk building. Hello?
I think so.
You think so?
That might be a question better answered by our interim superintendent, Maynard Hammer.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, for engaging in that one.
Thank you, Senator. And I know, Senator Gordley, you have a question. I'm going to ask one, though, before that. When we put this agenda together, we sort of debated about whether to let you go first or to let the next group go. And I think that you will be hearing a lot of very critical comments from people who work at the hospital, as well as from people who have represented patients or even been patients there. I wanted to ask you, so that you have a chance to perhaps not counter what they're going to say, but just tell us how you're thinking about this. In what way are the recommendations and the concerns of people currently working in the hospital, particularly ones that are not at high levels of management, being incorporated in the response that's being made and the plans that are being made? Because the kinds of things I suspect we will be hearing, maybe because you need to act quickly, are that a lot of things are being done that deal with some of the things that the Department of Justice has found, but that the responses are, a lot of them are about documenting, not so much about really helping deal with the problems. And so I wanted to give you a chance to just express your thoughts about some of what I think we will probably be hearing in the next hour. And anybody who wants to can respond.
To address that question is, the hospital is tracking through surveys, through forms that are available on each unit from staff, suggestions from staff and from patients. And those are all centralized and looked at all this information by our quality improvement office. And then leadership has the opportunity to look at these areas, specific areas of concerns, and then we look at what type of plan we can have to address those specific areas. So patients have that opportunity to provide feedback, and as well as line staff and any other staff in the hospital.
And currently, there are approximately 30 to 40 work groups that were created from the continuous improvement plan, which you've heard about. The continuous improvement plan also, in its creation, was shared with OSH staff and patients first before it was released publicly, and we accepted feedback and incorporated much of that feedback from patients and staff into the plan. And as I said, the work groups have been created, and those work groups are comprised of OSH management, leadership, staff, direct care staff, and patient representation. So in addition to the patient staff suggestion that Arthur Tolan mentioned, we have that mechanism for folks' involvement and being a part of the change process and being able to make suggestions.
I would say from a nursing perspective, just to be really honest with the committee, I think we can do better. And I think we need to do better. And I've been in the director of nursing role for about a year and a half and have tried to be as open and communicative and inclusive as I possibly can with the staff, to be as supportive as I can, and to involve folks in the process, including being responsive to union issues. And I would say to you that even folks that may come up and be somewhat dismayed, I think will also tell you that leadership at the hospital, and particularly relationships with the representative staff, have improved over the last couple of years, and I think for the most part that they would say that leadership is making concerted efforts to work with folks and to include them in all processes, because quite frankly the hospital runs on the backs of the line staff at the hospital, so it's important that they're included and involved and respected in that process. So it will be an ongoing effort for us. I think we also look forward to having a new superintendent and leadership that will help us focus and move in a positive direction towards the future. I would also say to you that most of our success stories get very little light a day, and that I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time telling you about all the successes we have, but we do have a lot. And I would also say to you that one of my best, as a director of nursing, litmus tests for that are the 9 colleges we work through having nursing students do their rotations. I personally meet with every class and debrief with every class at the end of the rotation and ask them specifically if after the rotation would they consider psychiatric nursing, and those percentages go up by about 80% at the end. We have people that want to come to the hospital that think and characterize the staff at the hospital as exceptional and extraordinary, and I would just say to you that we have a lot of successes. We have a long way to go. We have improvements to make, and it's very important for our patients that we make those improvements, but we also have some important successes as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I have one last statement?
I have a question from Senator Gordley.
Right.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate being able to participate in this committee. I'm looking at your report on protection from harm, and I want to key in on a couple of things that Senator Courtney raised. Looking at the actions, the first one, educated all staff on behavioral management and communication skills. When did that occur, and who provided the education or training, and is that ongoing?
Yes, ma'am. That would be related to our, it's called PROAC training, Professional Assault Responsiveness Training. So it's a behavioral management and communication training that looks at using least restrictive techniques. We do that with all new employees on hire. They receive 16 hours of training. And then annually, we provide an 8-hour training for all direct nursing care staff.
This statement, as it's written, says educated all staff on behavioral management and communication skills. So when did that occur, and who provided the education and or training? When did that occur?
All new employees receive that training, and all nursing care staff receive it annually. So it's an ongoing training for staff at the hospital.
Just for clarification, because I think what Senator Gordley is asking, it was clear to me, if you don't mind, she's asking you, since the report, and you're saying that you have done this training, when did you do it since the report? Is that the question, Senator?
Yes.
It's not as though we went forward and did a new training since the report. This is and ongoing training. And all hospital employees do get this when they come to the hospital. So over the course of years...
I don't want to interrupt you, but I do want to just kind of cut to the chase. The way this is written, it suggests that you've done something new or different since the findings, but that's not what I'm hearing in your response.
That's correct. It's not new or different.
So nothing different has taken place since the findings. No new education on behavioral management and communication skills to the existing staff.
Not that is different from the ongoing education that is offered in both of those areas.
The expanded falls reduction program hospital-wide, when did that take place? When did that, and how did you do that?
The falls reduction program got its roots in the geriatric treatment services, which you can imagine is where the bulk of our falls occur. And in 2006, we incorporated fall risk assessments hospital-wide. So for all folks that have more than two falls, they can have a risk assessment done to determine if there's something that needs to be addressed in their gait or medication or those sorts of things.
And again, so since the findings you've put in place, the falls reduction program, since the findings?
The falls reduction program was in place hospital-wide before the findings.
The established and implemented guidelines for intensive patient monitoring, when did that occur? When was that established? Since the findings?
I believe that we did that after the review. So it was in 2006 after the I'm having a little brain. Yes, after the, well, the USDOJ. Folks who, yes, the USDOJ, mm-hmm. after they came to the hospital.
The next one, revised and implemented risk assessment, et cetera, when did that occur? And again, was that since the findings?
excuse me, Senator Gourley. The revision of the risk assessment, dangerousness risk assessment, has been a project that's been worked on over the past several years by a team of psychologists. The implementation of the revised risk assessment has happened since the investigation.
The next item, training in asbestos awareness. Again, when did that training take place?
Senator Gourley, hold that thought. I think Mickey Logan, did you wish to come forward and perhaps, because I think one of the things that needs to be pointed out is we requested these specific people to respond, but they may not always be the best people to be answering some of our questions. So.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rosenbaum. Members of the committee. Senator Gourley, I would like to clarify something.
Yes, please tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm Mickey Logan. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General. I am the lead attorney on the USDOJ investigation, and I presented testimony earlier this month.
I heard your testimony.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify, I think something that's getting lost in this communication here is that the USDOJ did a very extensive exit interview in November 2006, and I think what Ms. Franz Geddes and Mr. Bischoff are not explaining adequately is that, the changes they're talking about, the continuous improvement plan, they went to work on that after November 2006. And no, it's true that they haven't revised this continuous improvement plan that much since January, although it has been changed extensively since January. The changes they're talking about, such as the annual trainings and those things and the changes in the incident reports, that has happened since the exit interview in November. Is that helpful, Senator?
Somewhat. What I'm trying to establish here is what is happening right now. And also, again, given the way this particular report is laid out, how are we to understand exactly what has been done, what has been completed,
timelines. It's just an incomplete picture.
And I wouldn't disagree with you on that. And that's consistent with what Representative Berger was getting at, is this is a high-level kind of thing, and you're not getting kind of detail that this committee, which is a very, very well-versed committee, needs. And I'm not sure there would be time in one hearing to get into all those details, but if I could ask Ms. Franz Geddes and Dr. Bischoff to maybe explain how things have changed since that exit interview that they were at, although I might add that that was the exit interview was Dr. Bischoff's first day at the hospital. And so the point of that is not to be amusing, but to say there has been some culture changes. They have a new superintendent coming on board, and I'm very hopeful there's going to be even more changes. And I think that's what you're really getting at, is that we can't go with the status quo.
Yeah, I'll just end it in my comments, my questions here, Madam Chair. Again, this part of the report is about protection from harm. So what have we done, clearly, that we can all see and talk about, and what remains to be done, and then, again, who's involved? Who's involved in making those things happen?
Your fingertips. I know that there's been a reduction in the number of falls since November 2006 in terms of the percentage. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And there's been a reduction in the number of assaults, and it's been a pretty significant reduction in the percentage. There's also been a reduction in the amount of hours people have been held in seclusion and restraint. And because of this data collection problem, it's hard to explain it, but from my perspective, representing the state of Oregon to the USDOJ, being able to tell them we are down however much, 25% or whatever, from what you viewed in November 2006, that is significant, to have less assaults. And I don't mean like four or five less. I mean a huge, like a 25% less. So that's significant in a litigation sense, but that's not still not enough. It's not nearly where they need to be. But is that the kind of information that's useful to you?
Certainly, data is useful. Real information in real time that measures or tells us where we are. That's what I'm sitting here listening for, and I'm hearing it to some degree, but it's not totally satisfying my need to be fully informed about where we are. No, it isn't.
Yeah,
fully satisfying.
And I wouldn't be if I were you either.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. And we're out of time. Unfortunately, don't leave, though, because Representative Tremaine
has... I'm just following up. Certainly, Senator Gordley stated what I want numbers. A high rate of falls. So what were the falls during the study? What are the falls now? Mr. President asked about environmental hazards. That was mentioned in the report. So tell us what they were and how that's been addressed. Give us specific information, not just general information. I think that's what Representative Berger was also asking for. Thank you.
And I want to thank you for your testimony. I do want to say that we presented you with probably an impossible task, which was to present an incredibly complicated document and set of responses in inadequate time to do it, and it's not enough time for the members to ask the questions that we have, but I think we felt it was extremely important to have, as part of this discussion, hearing from some of the people who are on the ground who developed the document, and I think you've done a fair job of trying to get the discussion started. This is by no means the end of that conversation. I also want to say that by jam-packing this agenda, we're inevitably going to be frustrating the people on this committee as well as some in the audience, but I felt personally it was very important that we have an opportunity to hear from patients, hear from staff, and that's why we're not devoting enough time probably to any portion tonight, but I'm hoping that this will be the start of a conversation, not the end of it. So thank you very much for being here. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I have a whole length of questions, and I'm not going to ask permission to proceed on those. But I'm sharing with the other members of the panel here some frustrations. I don't think we've gotten with the discussion tonight to some of the points I would like to have. I probably will submit these questions, which I have already given to the co-chairs, and pass them on to the agency and ask for some responses. That way it might be more expeditious to do
it
than it would be to waste, waste is the wrong word, but use our time here tonight with us. So I've been quiet, wanting everybody to speak on this and to ask their questions, but I just want to, you know, let you all know that there were things that that I have that haven't even started to be addressed, you know, here tonight.
I really appreciate that, Representative Jensen, and we will pass along those written questions, and I do think that's an extremely appropriate way to try to get some of this information is by putting it in writing, and then we'll get written responses. So thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you again for your testimony. And in the next portion, we'll be calling panels of witnesses. The first of the panels will be representatives of APSME, and we'll call Dr. Lori Skatch, Joe Thurman, and Frank Warner. Please come forward. And I believe that you were asked to limit your presentation to 10 minutes so that we would have some time for questions at the end. So if you could try to observe that, we'd appreciate it. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Lorraine Skatch, and I'm a staff psychiatrist at Oregon State Hospital. I'm board certified in psychiatry, and I've worked at Oregon State Hospital for 22 years. I'm the president of the Oregon State Physicians, AFSCME Local 3327, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you tonight on behalf of the physicians at Oregon State Hospital. I'm very familiar with the working conditions at Oregon State Hospital and the needs of the patients. My colleagues and I are specialists. We're psychiatrists and internists who work with in public psychiatry and taking care of severely and persistently mentally ill patients that the hospital serves. These are patients that cannot be served in the community because of the severity of their illnesses or due to the crimes that they've committed that have sent them to the hospital in the forensics treatment program. We work hard on a daily basis to provide for the care and treatment of these patients. We try to use the best evidence-based treatments that we can do and provide the most effective medication management to help them recover from their illnesses and develop the skills that they need in order to be reintegrated into the community. We've worked for years with these patients, and for years we've helped them to recover and move forward, despite the crumbling buildings, the limited resources that have been allocated for their care. Our caseloads have chronically been too large. And now we're suffering criticism from the Department of Justice for inadequate care because of our understaffing and the limited resources that we've been given. The Department of Justice has recommended to other facilities that the size of caseloads for these difficult patients on admission units be 10 to 12 patients per psychiatrist and 15 to 20 patients for long-term treatment units, similar to patients that I treat on Ward 50D. My licensed budgeted capacity on 50D for one psychiatrist is 39 patients and has been running closer to 43 to 45 patients for the past several years. My interdisciplinary treatment team consists of myself, one psychologist, one social worker, one mental health specialist who's a master's level counselor and does a lot of the therapeutic groups. My nursing staff, on day shift, I have 1 to 2 nurses and 4 CNA or mental health therapists for 43 patients. That's a day and swing shift. That's about the staffing. On night shift, there are 2 CNAs and 1 nurse to take care of the needs of 43 patients. I have a half-time ward clerk who covers 2 units, so is responsible for 88 to 90 patients and the staff and the payroll and the needs that come up for both units, splits time between both units. It's no surprise to me that the Department of Justice doesn't find that the treatment that we're providing is adequate. We don't have enough people to do the work that they would describe as adequate. I had a psychiatrist come to us who had been working in a private psychiatric hospital half-time and quit because the caseload was too high when his caseload was shifted from 4 patients to 6 patients in a private psychiatric hospital. At a Hawaii State Hospital, after the Department of Justice came through, the caseloads for psychiatrists on admission units were decreased to 10 per psychiatrist and to 15 in the long-term treatment ward. And they now have a waiting list of psychiatrists who want to work at the hospital, despite the fact that they have crumbling facilities, old facilities. At the state hospital, we work very hard to meet as many needs of our patients as we can. And we're committed to trying to help them despite the chronically neglected buildings, the limited resources, and the excessive caseloads. The crosswalk document that you've been presented with fails to acknowledge that the caseloads of the treatment teams are too hard and proposes to use consultants to help us learn how to improve our treatment care plans, improve our evaluations, improve medication management. Our staff psychiatrists were not included in the development of this plan, and we're angered and frustrated at the implication that our skills are inadequate. We're highly trained psychiatrists. Most of the psychiatrists have psychiatry boards. Many of them have subspecialty certifications. We're trained in evidence-based treatments and medication management. We've asked over the years for an increase in staff positions to reduce the number of patients that we're assigned to clinically care for. We agreed as a union to allow a short-term fix with Oregon Health Sciences University to provide some caseload relief while we recruited for new psychiatrists. But even if all of our staff psychiatrist positions were filled, the current allotment of doctors doesn't provide caseload relief to my ward and several other wards in the forensic treatment program. Our caseloads must be reduced if we're going to meet the Department of Justice criteria for adequate treatment. Our caseloads, the number of professionals that work as an interdisciplinary treatment team, needs to be increased at the hospital in order to meet their requirements. Consultation will not dig us out of this hole. We need more staffing power to bring caseloads to a reasonable level so that we can help our patients more effectively, so we can recruit people to come to our hospital, and that we can retain the people that come to our hospital and learn how to work with our patients and be able to provide for their care. It's important to have a new hospital, and we need that. And we all appreciate that we're moving forward with that and are grateful for you to push that and continue your promise in moving towards a new hospital. But we have more patients now at the hospital than the new hospital will have. And to have less staff now is very difficult to improve the level of care that people get. So we ask you to review carefully the report from the Department of Justice and take their critiques clearly under consideration. If caseloads are not reduced to a reasonable level by hiring psychiatrists and other staff that are experienced and willing to work in the public sector, we'll not be able to provide for the needs of the patients. There are different ways to provide treatment, and we're moving towards the new model of centralized treatment care. And this will help to a certain extent. But patients need to have access to their psychiatrist. Patients need to have access to their social worker. Patients need to have access to their psychologist to really have adequate care. The shortages must be directly addressed, and the shortages in all disciplines need to be reviewed. Recovery from mental illness is not a pipe dream, and it can be a reality for more citizens in Oregon if we work together to solve the problems. Thank you for your commitment for working on these problems now and in the years ahead as we rebuild our hospitals and design treatments for these people in desperate need for care. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. Co-chair and committee members, my name is Frank Warner. I'm a registered nurse. I work at Oregon State Hospital on the medium security forensics unit. I'm also vice president of the nurses union at the hospital. I've handed you kind of a general outline of what I was going to speak about, but I think Dr. Skatch has been pretty eloquently talking about our staffing crisis, and that was a lot of what I wanted to talk about. I would rather stand up here today and say that I'm very proud to be a nurse at Oregon State Hospital, and I'm not looking to bash our director of nursing services at all. As a matter of fact, over the last several years, we've had some of the best relationships that the hospital has had, and we're working together as a team to fix the problems that do exist. There was some things you guys were asking our director of nursing about. You wanted specifics. Maybe I can help you with some of those questions. You were talking about the incident reporting. The new incident reports are now on a computer. It's better able to capture the information than what we had previously. So we're working towards getting a lot of this information gathered, and as nurses on the floor, it's making it much easier on us to do these reports on a computer that we didn't have before. And I'm just going to let Joe talk and then open it up to questions from you.
Yeah, pardon me, Matt. Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Thurman, and I'm president of the Nurses Union at the Oregon State Hospital. And I've met with several members, I don't know, of this committee over the years to address these very issues on staffing problems at the state hospital. So it really should come as no surprise. One thing that I did notice out of all the reports, the Department of Justice, JCO, and even the Medicare surveys that we had, they commended us on some excellent staff at the state hospital. So for all our faults, we have some very dedicated, good, hardworking staff there. But having said that, we have been critically short-staffed for many, many years now. And we need to step up the plate, I think, as Oregonians and address this issue. Because the people that we serve at the state hospital, by and large, deserve adequate and good treatment and be able to be placed back in the community. You give us positions for the state hospital, and I think that's wonderful. But if we can't recruit for those positions, you can give us all the positions you want. The problem is people are not knocking down our door to come work for us. And part of that is the work environment, obviously. The buildings are falling down and they look horrible, so people drive by and they see this archaic building standing out there. But part of it is the compensation package that we offer new nurses coming out of school. Just 2 weeks ago, I had a nurse who'd been at the state hospital for 4 years and left and went over to Salem Memorial and is starting off at the top of our scale. That's disheartening. How do I compete with that when they're starting off at the very top and they're going over there for 3 12-hour shifts and getting paid for 40 every week? So we need to get in the ballpark with this. We need to get in the game. I mean, we have to be competitive with the outside world, or we're not going to be able to ever recruit enough quality staff. And that's what we're asking for, is quality staff. I don't want somebody that can fog a mirror. Quite frankly, staff like that make my job a heck of a lot harder to do. I want quality people in there. And I think we all want to do the best job possible for our clients. And it's very frustrating for me because from a nursing standpoint, I too have 43 patients on any given day that I am responsible for all their medical care, all the appointments made, any one-to-ones that need to be done, and stuff like that. And it's very difficult to get that all squeezed in one day. And I think that we as a group have a chance to make a big impact at the state hospital, and I think it's time to do it. You asked a question earlier about how many staff have been injured by assaults at the state hospital. Well, the exact number from last year is 334, so almost one a day. And that's patient direct assaults. That's not counting all other kinds of injuries at state hospital. I'm on the central safety committee, so we track that on a monthly basis, and they actually have a breakdown. I believe I gave a copy to Senator Winters at one time, so she's probably got that data later. That's unacceptable. And what we're finding too is that we're getting less and less younger staff being attracted to the system. We're getting We have a lot of staff that have been there for years and years and years, but we don't, we're not getting a bunch of younger staff coming in. And what we need to do is work toward that. The other piece of that is we have our front door wide open because of laws that have been passed that says we have to take people within a certain amount of time. But yet our rear door in the community saying, not in my community, is barely cracked. But I don't know that if everybody knows this, but the Department of Corrections recidivism rate is somewhere around 30%. Ours is 13. Big difference. But I think that's information that needs to get out there. And I also think that we need to educate Oregon, period, that mentally ill people, by and large, are a lot less assaultive than the regular general, than DOC people when they're on their medications. Okay? And that's all I want to say.
Thank you. If you have any questions. Thank you for your comments. We'll take a few questions. We've got about 5 minutes for questions for this panel. And Representative Clem.
Thank you. I just wanted to just confirm something, then I have a new question. But Dr. Sketch, you said that your current patient load is something like 43. Mm-hmm. It's budgeted for 39, but it's actually 43 for just you.
Yes, that's true.
And in Hawaii, a psychiatrist would have 10 at this point. 10 to 15, you said, in some cases.
They would probably have 15. I visited Hawaii State Hospital about a year ago and spoke with the chief medical officer there, and he said that they were creeping up to 18 now because they, too, have trouble placing people in the community. But that would be for one psychiatrist. And on a similar kind of medium security major treatment ward population that I have, I do have 43 patients right now.
And just keep going. And that's post going through a process like we did where they decided, they're investigated, decided to fight it, ended up being sort of told what your ratios are going to be and handed a bill, and that's where they're at now. That's what we've heard over the weeks, that Hawaii didn't just, come up with a plan. They were essentially put into receivership or something.
Correct.
And then eventually.
Correct.
So that's what we might be looking forward to, and those sort of ratios, either voluntarily that we come up with or that happens to us anyway, basically.
It's possible.
And then just, you have this huge number of patients, obviously. I'm sure that's not comparable to what's out there in a private psychiatric facility. I assume it's more like 10 or 15.
Well, there are not private psychiatric facilities that take care of the criminally court-committed patients that comprise my ward. My patients are predominantly people who have been sent to the hospital because they've been convicted of crimes and sent for treatment until they're ready to be returned to the community.
I'm sorry, I forgot about that. You're in the forensic area. And just sort of lumping it in, so I know you've got this huge amount of patients. What's it like for any one patient? How much time do you spend on intake for just one patient?
If a patient's directly admitted to my ward and I have to do all the paperwork, it will take me 4 to 6 hours to do all the admission work, including a dictation of the summary of my findings.
Yeah, I think we've talked about on a daily basis, you have to largely sign off on mouthwash usage. And we've talked about some of the things that you have to sign off on because they really are at that level of supervision.
Anything that the patient needs from a medical standpoint, including, alcohol-free mouthwash, if they have their own vitamins that they want to bring in and use, I have to review them. They have to be sealed bottles. They have to go back to the pharmacy and be labeled with my instructions. If they need an aspirin, I have to write an order for that. So anything that's over-the-counter, anything that is not, and we do have toothpaste that is given out to patients, as supplies, but if they wanted a special toothpaste or a white brightening toothpaste that they wanted their parents to bring in, I'd have to write an order for that on supply.
And just one last question.
Final question.
And this is probably for all of you. I think I got some of your answer. It's both pay better and get the staffing ratios down, but overall, what can we do to improve recruitment and retention of both doctors and, line staff?
Well, from a nursing standpoint and line staff in general, because the majority of the hospital is under nursing, I think that we have to be competitive with the outside sector. And I presented the information with comparables in bargaining last year and was pretty much ignored by DAS. And they came up with their own data and showed that we were at 106% of market. This is just an example. You can go in Marion County and look at their jail system right here in the county, and they're above us starting, above our top staff. So we have to at least, I'm not saying we have to pay above everybody, but we have to be competitive, and we're not. And the other thing is, I was in a meeting yesterday, and the police and firemen retirement program would be a good one. And from what I understand, it doesn't cost anything out of pocket. It's not... It'd be some recognition for the staff, and it would help them be able to retire a little bit earlier. But that's a relatively cheap thing, at least at the front end. But that gets some of the people in through the door. I mean, I got to tell you, I got some student nurses that are interested in coming to the work at the hospital. Well, when they find out our compensation package, it's no. Why should I?
And I'd like to add, too, that I believe that the position distribution for the psychiatrist needs to be relooked at. We do have some wards right now that are probably at allocations that are similar to Department of Justice standards. We have a maximum security ward for the 370 patients where they have a caseload of approximately 24 and they have two psychiatrists working full time on that unit. Some of the units we've worked to try to reduce their staffing level so that they would be more reasonable. But because we have no control over the front door, units like mine, which are considered, you know, treatment units, but, you know, less violent or whatever, are, you know, they tell me that my caseload would be 39, and that's not acceptable in any of the reports that I've reviewed for Department of Justice, and there should be two psychiatrist positions on my ward so that we could recruit somebody to come and work with me and have it be a state hospital position.
Senator Carter?
Thank you. Mr. Warner, thank you so very much, because you did come before my committee and you have come on more than one occasion talking about the shortage that you're faced with. My concern, colleagues, is kind of a legislative thing, because what I'm hearing is that you guys don't have control over the numbers of people that the judges or the courts send to you. So when you have more than what is allowed, as in your case 39 versus 42, you can't say to the court, we're crowded or we're overloaded, nothing of that nature. You just have to take the people as they come.
There was a court finding with the Ninth Circuit Court that said that we would take anybody that the court sent within 7 days. And we don't have, you know, it's not that we can say we have no beds. We find a bed, we put it into a two-man room, make it a three-man room, and go up in census. And that's how it works. And so, you know, my license budgeted capacity is 39, but we have more people obviously sleeping on the ward than 39 when I have 43 patients. And it's been up to 45 during the past couple of years.
Can I speak to that briefly, too? One of the problems we have, which I see, and I'm sure Dr. Skash does too, is I get people adjudicated from some of the counties where there's a deal met with the patient and the DA's office and the defense attorney or judge or whatever, where they're adjudicated. And once they're adjudicated, we have a very difficult time getting them out from underneath the board. So once these counties make that determination, I'll give you an example. I talked to a county the other day, it's been probably a month and a half ago, and I asked the sheriff there in, or one of the officers there in the county, why is this person coming? And they said because they had made a deal to come to state hospital as opposed to going to DOC. And that's part of the problem, too.
So some of PSRB, some of civil, and... You don't. So then I'm back to discharging now because I'm getting, this is a little complicated here. No wonder it goes bump here. So then discharging, if you can't find a place in the community, then the person stays at the hospital.
That's correct.
Now, is there any possibility of litigation or anything on the part of families if...
Some of the patients that are sent to the hospital have committed very serious crimes, arson, sex offenses, murder, and those patients, by nature of their crime, are not going to be found acceptable in a short-term period of time to be transitioned back into the community. The communities that sent them under the PSRB for murder are not likely to want them to come back in a short period of time, even if their mental illness is stabilized. And so some of the patients have a longer track record of good behavior that they're going to have to show in different levels in the hospital, and in maximum security before they come to medium security, in medium security before they go to minimum security, the residential wards, and in residential wards before a county mental health center is going to be able to take them back into the county that they came from. There's a with some of our patients, there's a big uprising at PSRB hearings when we go and recommend conditional release placement for people, and the county and the victims come to the hearing and testify that they're not ready for this person to be out of the hospital yet. And so the discharge is not merely based on whether or not their mental illness is stabilized and under control and they have good, you know, treatment skills and can do things. It's also a matter of being acceptable again back into the communities that they're sent from. And that does delay movement back into the community. And then we have places, I think it was Cornelius, the group home, where we send people to a locked, secure residential facility, which is basically, you know, they're locked into the building. They don't leave without staffing. And the communities still have difficulty having those kind of placements in their neighborhoods because they're afraid of the patients that need that level of supervision being their neighbors. And so we have difficulty building the places in the community where we can send our patients. We don't discharge.
Dr. Sketch, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We could go on with you for the rest of the evening, but we have a lot more people we need to hear from. So I want to thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you
for the great work that you're doing, too. Next, I'll call a panel from Oregon State Hospital Service Employees International Union. I'll call Jim Walker, Dan Smith, and Lou Cronenberg. If anybody still has their cell phone on in the room, I haven't heard it lately, but please turn it off. If anybody wants to see a lunar eclipse, I hear there's one going on outside, but we are not going to interrupt this hearing for that purpose. So, yes, Representative Jensen.
While the next panel is getting ready, this PSRB issue has come to my attention as we've gone through this for the last report. Meetings the last four meetings, I guess, now that we've had. It's an issue that I'm really concerned about and I'm looking into, and I'm trying to get some folks with the legal knowledge to help me work a little bit through this. I find it absolutely appalling that, no offense meant to the good co-chair from the Senate on this, but I find it appalling that two attorneys are making a diagnosis that I would think is a mental health specialist, a psychiatrist, or doctor in psychology to be making. And I don't know, it appears to be a really complicated issue. Some of the folks from the division can help me, with that if they'd like to. But I really want to take a look at that issue and see if there isn't something we can do that may prevent this issue. And I understand it works both ways. That some people come to the hospital, because it's an easier route out for them, and other people, the defense attorney, tells them you don't want to plead to, we don't want to plead to that, because if we do, you'll never get out. If you go to the correction system, you got two and a half years or something, and you're out from underneath of the state control. But I think that's a real complicated issue and one that does directly affect us and the people here.
Thank you. Please go ahead. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Smith. I'm here as a representative of Service Employees International Union, Local 392 of the Oregon State Hospital. You may notice that Mr. Walker and Mr. Cronenberg are not with us tonight. Ms. Chapman has agreed to step in for them because of other issues that they were facing. Ms. Chapman will have our opening remarks.
Thank you very much. This is my first time, so please forgive me ahead of time if I don't do the protocol correctly.
Don't worry about it.
Can
just tell
us
who you are, and then go ahead and tell us what you have to say.
My name is Donnell Chapman. I am an MHTT. I am at the bottom of the MHT series. I work the floor. You've heard from my nurses, you've heard from my supervisors, you've heard from all of them about what's going on at the hospital. It's true. What I want to tell y'all is about what happens when we have short staff. Short staff means for me that after I've worked my 8 hours, and I work night shift, I get to do a mandate of another 8 hours on today's shift for a total of 16 hours. That means I get to go home at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, meaning that I had probably got up at 3 o'clock the day before, which makes a 24-hour period. The MHT staff are the heart and the soul, basically, of the hospital. We work the floor. We do all the things that the nurses don't. We are the ones that do the one-to-ones. We are the ones that are responsible for SNR, watches, anything that is not given up to supervisors. And then the other thing I want to stress is during that 16 hours, we're also dealing with the most difficult clients in the state. The DOJ report came off, some of the incidents that you all spoke to about how could this happen, is one of our most difficult units in the hospital to work. It's an intake unit, and it's all female. Some of the questions was, how can this person on a one-to-one get a cleaning solution and drink it? Well, what they didn't tell you is that three staff chased this person down. Two fell. One, and the third one, was able to get their hands on this person and hold them as they're throwing it up in the air and spraying everybody with it. This person didn't have to have her stomach pumped or anything like that. We managed to get it out of her hand ahead of time. You also ask how these places are not cleaned up, how there's fecal material on the wall. It's probably because the client was in there and was too angry for any of us to go in and not have to wear what she was smearing all over the wall. So as a CMA, MHT in that, I have to say that the best possible solution to most of these problems is more staff. We don't have enough staff in the buildings that we're working in, and that's what we need most. I also wanted to tell you, Senator Courtney, that I work in the 41 building. I work on the second floor of that building that they are saying that is not adequate. And so, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to ask them.
I have a few remarks prepared, but I'd like to point out we've handed out the local 392 response to the CRIPA report. You'll find in there that we have addressed each of the five basic areas that have already been addressed. We've also used long-term goals that DHS presented previously. We have offered our support and our critique of those, including some suggestions directly from the staff at the hospital. We represent about 750 employees of the hospital. As Ms. Chapman said, we are the heart of the hospital, the direct hands-on care for the vast majority that takes place at the hospital is done by members of our local. Also included in there is a quality quality assurance plan review. If you look on page 7, we have adapted the a method of determining the value of quality improvement programs from the American Psychological Association. In previous hearings of this committee, we have heard you say, how do we know if this is a good plan? How do we know if this is working? This is our suggestion as something that you can look at. And then the last two pages of these materials are abbreviations that are commonly used throughout the hospital and may be used in our discussion tonight. It's just kind of a way to orient you. Now is not a time for us to point fingers and make accusations. It's an opportunity, and we very much look forward to it. Right now, the wage scales throughout the hospital lag behind the private sector for all of the hospital staff. Recruitment and retention are difficult issues, and they need to be addressed. These are issues that we, as a union, that AFSCME has been bringing to the administration's attention for quite some time. We present ourselves here to support the efforts to improve the quality of care within the hospital and to ensure that staffing levels meet those goals. We can and we will address wages and benefits at the bargaining table. We hope that the members of the legislature will recall these meetings when that bargaining takes place. With that in mind, we have specific suggestions that we believe will help to meet the needs of the hospital. First, recruit, train, and hire the full complement of staff needed to operate the Oregon State Hospital at current federally recommended standards beginning today. Mm-hmm. To wait or postpone this action is to continue the decade-long shortage of staff that contribute to every problem named in the Department of Justice report. There are four specific things that we believe will help in that process. First, actively seek women and men at all levels within the mental health field, from our MHTs, the people who do the hands-on day-to-day work, to our psychiatrists and everybody in between. Second, begin providing pay and benefits at least as good as the prevailing community standards. We believe that it is time for the state of Oregon to begin offering incentives for people to work at the state hospital. This may include student loan paybacks. This may include relevant continuing education for professional development and continuing full benefits, medical benefits that we currently enjoy. And our fourth suggestion is providing a new facility that meets the needs of the staff as well as the needs of the residents. Psychological and psychiatric literature is clear. The only surefire way, the only guaranteed way to reduce violence in a psychiatric hospital is to increase the amount of space that is available. Now, all of the other things, therapeutic interventions, groups, social activities, recreational activities, and vocational activities help to reduce violence. But when enough space is provided, then that violence is reduced even more. Next, in completing the design for the new hospital, I encourage you all to plan for a shortfall in the availability of community beds. I encourage you to consider the continued reluctance of the Psychiatric Security Review Board to release residents who have stabilized medically. And I'd also encourage you to consider the continued lack of funding for community-based mental health services in Oregon. All of these are issues that directly impact the hospital, both in the residents who come into the hospital and those residents that are discharged. Specifically, address the statutes, the administrative rules, and what we believe to be old patterns of habit that prevent the Oregon State Hospital from controlling who is admitted and who is discharged. This will, of necessity, affect the referral of individuals who plead guilty except for insanity, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Department of Human Services, the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and Oregon State Hospital protocols. We take this very seriously. We know that you do, too. We have a perspective down in the trenches, and we can't see nearly as much of what's going on as you can. We very much respect the work that you're doing, and we thank you for doing it, because we know that it's thankless. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to try and answer them.
Well, thank you for your comments, and thank you for what clearly was a great deal of work that went into preparing your written responses, which I see there are, in addition to the ones you referred to, there are others in front of the members. So are there questions for these witnesses? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Ms. Chapman, could you tell us about your level of training? You're an MHT, a mental health therapist, right?
Yes, I am. I have a CNA slash CA.
You need to tell me what that means.
Okay. I am a certified nurse's assistant, and I am a certified medical assistant. I took the extra training that was provided through the hospital so I can pass meds. I have training that's provided annually, the PRO Act that they spoke to, and I have a high school diploma and a year of college.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Clem.
Just one. A mandatory, so that's when you described you worked 16 hours, for example. when you came to work that day, do you know you're going to be there at that point? Or how does that work in your life?
Well, if you work night shift, what usually happens, the shift is over at 6:45. Usually at about 5:30, you get a phone call from centralized staffing saying, guess what, you're mandated. Well, not guess what.
Right, but
yeah. And then
5:45 in the morning, you're finding out that 45 minutes later, instead of going home, you're going to work another 8 hours.
Exactly. And, you know, they try their best to work it, but sometimes they can't. On the other units, I work in the residential unit, and it's a little easier. But on the intake units, where they have to have so many staff, they have to stay the full 8 hours.
Yes, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The prevalence of that happening, the number of times, like how many hours did you work last year?
Well, see, I'm the wrong one to ask. You'd have to ask the intake units because, like I said, I'm out on the far end of the spectrum. I'm in residential. We pretty much take care of our own. When they open it up hospital-wide is usually when I get tagged. And our particular unit, they have a lot of old staff on that have been there a long time, so we kind of take care of our own, and we really try not to do that. But on the other units where they have more staff, the statutes, we have a mandate list that shows who's up next. It's not uncommon to see 6 or 7 mandates on that particular unit in a month.
If I could, please. There are currently about 41 full-time positions at the hospital that are being filled by mandates and agency staff. Agency being a private for-profit organization that provides nurses and other staff to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So the equivalent of about 41 full-time positions filled by mandates and private for-profit corporations. I just like to follow up. I kind of want to understand, in a typical work situation, how often you work that double shift.
Like I said, on my unit, we take care of our own, and we're pretty lucky. On the other units?
Excuse me, I don't understand what we take care of our own means.
Okay.
In terms of how often do you work the shift. I mean, once a week does it happen to you, or once a month? Or?
Like I said, I'm on a residential unit. It doesn't happen to me as often. On an average, it goes for me maybe every month. On the other units, it's like 2 and 3 times a week for them because they're higher levels, more staff, more difficult clients.
And I just want to understand this because in lots of staffing situations, mm-hmm. especially in 24/7 type situations, they would make some attempt to split shift those additional shifts. Is that done as well? Currently, the hospital does not routinely allow split shifts, does not allow MHT line staff workers to flex their schedules. Many people volunteer for overtime, and many mandates are covered by voluntary overtime, but not nearly enough. We have some individuals who work an extra 20 hours a week, so 60 hours a week routinely. Most of that voluntary, some of that mandated.
And that's what I meant by taking care of our own.
Okay, thank you. I've been quiet, but I just got a couple of thoughts here.
Go ahead.
So I have two thoughts here. We just got your report, which looks really great. I mean, I appreciate that you put a lot of effort into the report, which I think will be nice for us to be able to review and compare against what we've seen from the federal government and the things they had to say. As it applies to the 211 people that have been proposed to be added, do you specifically address that in your report, the 211 FTEs that have been requested to resolve some of the issues? Is that covered in your report? That is not covered in the report. We would be happy to respond to that, but at this point, we do not have that information in our hands.
Okay. Thank you. And, Madam Chair, if we could, I know we had the nursing supervisor here at one point, and I'd just like to understand the practice of either, and we don't have to do it right now, but I'd like to understand the practice of the double shift versus why we don't split shift some of those issues and what the ruling, what the protocol is within the hospital. It would seem unusual to me that they would not do that, given that you're asking somebody to do patient care for 16 straight hours when you could right. split that shift in two. I'd like to further understand
that
process.
Those are great questions. I would guess that probably one of the things that's going on, given what you have told us and what we've been hearing about the difficulty of retaining people in these jobs, is that it's probably very difficult to adequately staff and fill these positions as people are being trained and then they leave for other jobs that are easier jobs at other places. And I know that there's not adequate time to explore this, but I think you're raising some really good points. But I think there probably are challenges where it seems like there just would be logical solutions on paper, but when you're talking about real people and real patients, it's by no means so easy to make this work in a situation where you clearly are overworked, understaffed, and up against a lot of pressure to try to solve a problem fairly quickly. So
that's absolutely true, Madam Co-Chair. And I would just encourage all the members of the committee to look into the Statesman's Journal and the Oregonian and see how many positions are not advertised that we have open. If you want to know about how many jobs are available at the Oregon State Hospital, log on to the DHS website, make your way through that to the employment website, and then if you put in the right information, you'll find out how many positions are open at the Oregon State Hospital. We have been asking specifically for increased recruitment well over the past year. Forgive my frustration, but the good people that we have are aging. And they're being injured. They're working for less than their counterparts in nursing homes and other facilities throughout the state. Thank you.
I'd like to add one thing that you all could possibly do for us, at least in forensics, is we need the police and fire retirement benefits. That would be a really good perk for our forensic people, and it would be something that might keep people coming so we can retire earlier, because it is a very physical job what we do. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks for being here. And I think now we're at the point where we're going to have a telephone witness, and we have a panel of Bob Chunda from the Oregon Advocacy Center, the person who's on the telephone, Tayemba Yafu, Chris Bonaf from the National, from NAMI, and then also Megan Coffey, and you probably won't all, well, I guess all three of you will be able to sit at the table because we then have somebody on the phone.
Are we ready?
I think, wait just one moment, and we'll hear first from Bob Jundep, and then we'll hear from you.
Madam and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Jundep. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center, and I'm very happy today to be able to introduce to you Tayemba Yafu, who is a patient.
Could you, Bob, move the microphone closer to you? Thank you.
Who is a patient at the Oregon State Hospital. Tayemba has served for a couple of years now on an advisory council that we have in our organization. We have a group of people who are primarily consumers of mental health services who advise us as to our services and set our priorities for each year of service. And for a number of years now, we've had a person who resides at the state hospital who served on that council. And Tayemba has been, as I said, a very valuable member of the council. And so I'd like to hand it over to him, because there's nothing like hearing from someone who lives there and knows what it's like.
Okay, Tayemba, we are ready to hear from you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak, and I will try not to be verbose or convoluted or redundant. I've been listening very hard at everything that was spoken, so I'm trying not to talk about the things that have been spoken, but I will tell you the things that I will concur with. That is not having enough staff, the overcrowding. And just give you a close example of that. I live in a room where there are six people. And if you can imagine living in a room where there are six people with a space of each person of about 12 square feet, each having their own different music, having their own little idiosyncrasies, different medications, different temperaments, etc. It gets pretty complex at times, tense, and sometimes gets into a physical level. I've been in the hospital for 15 years here, almost 15 years, and I have seen quite a few transitions. Though times are hard, I must say that I am one of the more blessed ones because of how I handle things. I try to look at the positive rather than negative, so I'm not here to bash staff or anyone else. I know it's a very difficult situation we're looking at. I happen to be fortunate enough to have a job that is part of the patient pay program, which I think needs to be advanced, and for a very specific reason, because this particular job I have allows me to still be very responsible, even though I am here, and take care of my children, those that are the younger ones that still require my help, and also to help finance a son that's over in Japan going to college, though my contributions are not as significant as he would need, and also to help my victim survivors. This patient pay is very important because those who do not have it will go to crime, extortion, theft, you name it, so they can provide for their needs. So I put emphasis on that. I think that in light of all the things that I've seen and heard, I'd like to make a couple of recommendations in terms of things that could be improved, and not speak about the things that have already been spoken of, and me taking a consensus since I've been here with other patients. There needs to be more time spent with patients doing things to get rid of some of their frustrations here in the idle time, like more exercising on outside or inside, and I hope the new facility will provide for that, but in the meantime, that hopefully can be provided here. The numbers in terms of staffing are not really looked at as it has been spoken to, because those numbers vary when appointments take place, and those staff that are already overextended have to go to appointments with patients and therefore make the patient to staff ratio even less than what it actually is. Consequently, a lot of patients are not able to partake in the things that they should, that would prevent them not only from getting in trouble, but from also learning and getting the prerequisites that are necessary for their recovery when they leave here. I would like to say that there is one thing that I would like to mention that patients have a great high concern of, and that I have too. I have never been as sick as I have been in this hospital in my life from someone, obviously, who brought it in, because basically we're vulnerable here. And I feel that when 180 staff become ill from an illness that is based not airborne but on contact, then there is something going wrong there. I think that really needs to be dealt with, because too often we get infected here and we're not responsible for it. And yes, we may take the prerequisites, but many do not, in order to prevent that spread from taking place. Patients have mentioned that they would like to have better communications and reduce the financial burden in doing so. I think this is very therapeutic for patients. We are set with a ratio of about 2 to 3 phones on each ward with 43 to 45 patients. That creates a very bad situation in logistics when people do not want to follow sharing those phones, and even when sharing them, the numbers, the ratios are not correct. Financially, it is a burden because a 10-minute call will average $4.49 with the current cards that are used in the hospital, and when I got these cards for the patients, they were much, much cheaper. The cards that are still available would cost them 72% cheaper. So therefore, instead of a card that costs $4.49, you're talking about a card that would cost $1.29 in that call. I think that patients should have the autonomy to use cell phones, whatever they may be, so that they would have the autonomy to not only call out, but also to receive calls from their most valued people, their loved ones and family. In terms of, I heard some conversation having to do with how people are brought from one level to another in the transition. That is not taking place. And I'm not saying to what degree, but just from my personal experience of being here, there are people who are being brought straight from the streets in very sick conditions who are not going from maximum security, but are going straight to medium security. And I mean people who are really, really sick. And that tells me that the hospital has changed in terms of how they are no longer screening people, because these people are mixing with people who are not as ill as they are. And yes, they are also are taking low function people and putting them with high function people. And this and the dynamics that exist cause a great deal of fights and problems as well. I think that really needs to be curtailed. I think I was only given, as I was told, about 5 minutes. And the most important things that I think need to be dealt with to bring down the recidivism that exists here, which I understand, the last time I checked, is somewhere in the 95 percentile. If I'm wrong, I need to be corrected. But I do know that the revocation from using drugs and alcohol are not as significant enough to have someone here kept beyond the period of time where they can no longer fend for themselves, that is, where they become so institutionalized that they want to, in their subconscious, become very hedonistic and lead a life where they have two regrets. One to stop sleeping to eat, and the other one is to stop eating to sleep. Unfortunately, I have seen this transpire too often. Therefore, obesity is a problem, and obesity changes into diabetes. I will stop now to see if I have gone beyond my limits, and if I have, then I would be willing to cease at this time. I also do know that I would like to say that when I first came here, there were stoves and ovens where we could cook our own meals. There were families that came on the wards with us and shared meals with us. The visiting was altogether different, too. We were not harassed by the security who were supposed to be there to secure us, but not to cause interruptions within our visits.
Tehimba, thank you very much for your comments. And I think at this point I'm going to ask the members of our committee if they have any questions for Tehimba before I take testimony from the other witnesses. And I think I don't see any questions for you, so if you can stay with us on the phone, we will keep going. And Bob, does that complete your portion of the testimony?
Yes, I'm sure. I know you have limited time.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead. Chris or either one of you?
Co-chairs Rosenbaum and co-chair Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I'm the peer wellness coordinator of Bidden County Health Services. I also serve on the board of directors of Mental Health America of Oregon, previously known as the Mental Health Association of Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity to come before you and speak on behalf of Mental Health America of Oregon, and more succinctly, to try to give voice to the persons whose voices are only being heard tonight through Tehimba, but largely are not being heard tonight because they're hospitalized at our state hospital. These issues have a very immediate and profound meaning for me because I know firsthand what it is like to be locked up in an institution. Before I entered into the time of my life that I will call my recovery, I was hospitalized over 100 times, sometimes for months at a time. And I must say that I know firsthand what it is like to be in seclusion and four-point restraint, as I have known that condition many times in the past. There are several areas in the Department of Justice CRIPA report that I'm going to focus on in my testimony. They are the need of quality and quantity of adequate assessments, the need for adequate treatment, and the necessity for discharge planning that ensures that patients have a timely discharge into an integrated setting and that they are provided with the skills and treatments needed so that they will succeed when they return to our communities. I am speaking on behalf of Mental Health America of Oregon, and I need to say that while we on the board all agree that action must be immediate and substantial in correcting the problems at the state hospital, there is not total consensus as to whether it is possible to actually affect the level of systemic change we see as being necessary for the problems to be solved in any truly meaningful, non-cosmetic way. I personally am of a hopeful attitude. I say I am hopeful because I think we are dealing with, in essence, a problem that has a great deal to do with the perception of hope. We currently have to take an environment at the state hospital where some persons are ascribing to a culture of despair and replace it with a culture of hope. Giving persons appropriate assessments in a timely manner, including the form of person-centered treatment plans, is a start. And I was encouraged to hear people talking about the RAP plans tonight. That's the right direction to go. If clinicians believe that the patients that they are assessing are capable of recovery from their mental illness, that's so powerful. Simply stated, recovery might be defined as the person's ability to live a life which that person finds meaningful and gratified, which he or she determines themselves, and which is characterized by an inclusive social role in a community of that person's choosing. The expectation of recovery is a profound concept which is communicated from mental health providers to patients through language, nonverbal cues, as well as through therapeutic conventions and interventions, and through the physical environment as well. This belief and expectation conveys hope and also respect, and it is a powerful ally for the patient's own will and incentive to heal. Some clinicians and mental health technicians understand this innate sacred quality about their patients, and they skillfully nurture it. Some of those people are here tonight. To them, we all owe our respect and our gratitude, and I want to say thank you. Some workers, however, the patients to them are alien and hopeless, and the only way they know to relate is to control them. These people are probably in the minority. The atmosphere of fear and violence breeds more of the same, and a culture of despair in this situation is the norm. It is my understanding that in 2006, seclusion and restraint hours for patients were approximately 16,000 hours, and in 2007, the number was still an alarming 13,000 patient hours. The crosswalk document says that the trend was downward for the first one half of 2007 and upward for the second half of 2007. This says to me that there is still a coercive quality in too many of the staff-to-patient interactions. Violence is still an acceptable alternative in too many situations. Because of this, I am not convinced that simply adding more staff will solve the problems that still exist at the hospital, although I hear that it is very important to do this. It is essential that there be a shift from the culture of fear to a culture of hope, Otherwise, the same maladaptive patterns will just be repeated on a broader scale with new staff adopting the tone and culture of the old form. It is
Megan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and clearly you've got really valuable testimony. We have your written testimony, and I'm wondering if you might be able to skip part of it so that we can leave some time for questions at the end of this panel.
Yes. I will say that I wanted to question if there is not a better way to treat people with serious and persistent mental illness than with mental institutions as in large hospitals. I wanted to point out that the CRIPA report said that we would be in violation of OMSTED if we do not accomplish timely discharge of patients. And it also recommends that the Oregon State Hospital contract with community providers to provide placement on the non-rejection basis or implement a state-operated system of community-operated residential services to help with discharge placements into communities. And I think this would have to be happen on a legislative level that communities would be mandated to take placements into their communities. This does not happen at this time, and this would help counter the not in my backyard resistance problem. But what is really needed is a massive anti-stigma, anti-discrimination campaign, and this is work that each and every one of us can do. But that CRIPA report recommendation, I think, is something that could be taken up on a legislative level, and I would urge this committee to look into that. You have my comments, and I wanted to say we must act on the side of hope and health, because we are here tonight, and a lot of people are locked up at this moment, but we are free. And let us act on the movement of hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Co-Chair Rosenbaum, Co-Chair Courtney, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Chris Bonf. I'm president of NAMI Oregon. We are the state organization for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, group representing consumers and family members. You have my written comments. As a state, you might expect us to be rather alarmed by the Department of Justice report, but in fact, we're not surprised by it at all. I mean, this is just a continuing saga of crisis after crisis after crisis at the state hospital. And it's really a series of crises that face our entire mental health system. I heard Mr. Joondeff on the radio the other day state something that I think should be stated, that his organization has sued the state hospital five times. Just in this short period of time, now we're at our sixth area where we may face litigation if the Department of Justice continues down its path and the state doesn't respond. I mean, clearly, the Department of Justice has shown in other states that it's willing to take a state into litigation, as it did in Hawaii, and to force changes. But those changes go beyond just the state hospital. I mean, in Hawaii, they took on the entire community health system, and they looked at it as a holistic approach. They looked at it as to the state hospital was just, you know, our approach in Oregon, we look at the state hospital sometimes as this monument that it's the end and the start of our process, and really it's only one piece of a gigantic puzzle, and yet we treat it as if it's the only piece sometimes. We don't look as to where it connects into the community and how people get in and how people should get out and where people should go. What we've done is each time there's a crisis, we respond. We throw money at the state hospital. We look at staffing. And we look at things that are very, very important, but we look at them in isolation from everything else. And at the same time, the very bodies and agencies that oversee the state hospital turn around and starve the community health system. You have a community health system out there made mostly of nonprofits who do this work day in and day out, meeting the same standards that the Oregon State Hospital is held to because they have to. Otherwise, the state would revoke their license. And yet the bodies that care, we're talking about $7 or $8 million right now, a roll-up of $28 million to add staff, out there, providers that I've worked for, we're lucky after years of frozen contracts to get maybe 2% as a COLA. And that's if the legislative body is willing to open its purse strings. And here we are talking again about the state hospital, another crisis. Well, business as usual in this state has been to respond to this crisis, to react rather than act. We look for what we want. What our perspective is to use this opportunity. Once again, we have another opportunity to the state. And the question is, are we going to react or are we going to act? Are we going to use this opportunity, a new awareness that exists in this state about mental health and its integration into physical health and the integration of acute psychiatric care with community mental health care so that we can keep people from reaching the state hospital and we can treat people after they come out of the state hospital? Are we going to use this opportunity to do something different? Because business as usual has not worked. Throwing money at a crisis has not worked. We will end up back where we are right now. We will have a task force. We'll have a special committee. We'll be in the same position we've always have been. I think it shows out there, and I think we're at a moment in our state's history where we can do something different. I mean, certainly we passed parity after a 10-year battle, and I think, Senator Carter, you mentioned we didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get out of here overnight. But after 10 years, we have parity. We have the best parity legislation in the nation. We are the gold standard. We certainly can lead on issues. We have shown that in this arena. And it's time. I think the opportunity is there to do this. And as an organization, NAMI Oregon, we stand ready to partner with the state. We stand ready to partner with the agencies. We stand ready to work with the caretakers of the system. I'd like to add one other thing is that if there's one thing that we do in this special session, it's the past Senate Bill 1098, and I heard news tonight that it moved out of Ways and Means, and that's a simple bill that finally audits what the state is spending on mental health, not only from DHS, but every part of our system. And we can finally find out what are our dollars buying, and can we use those dollars more effectively to buy us the system that we want and we deserve. And again, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for this panel?
Senate Bill 1089, right? 1089, you said 1098.
1098, I'm sorry, yes.
1089, Senate Bill 1089. And at this hour, it's amazing anybody can keep these numbers straight. Well, I want to thank you very much for your testimony, and I think that this committee does not want to be part of the problem, really. I don't mean to just quote a slogan, but I think that we don't want to be just another committee that sits here and makes life harder for patients or staff or the people that have to deal with this problem. I think what people here are trying to do in the questions that you're hearing from us is figure out how to take this opportunity and turn it into something of lasting significance for the state. And it's not easy, obviously, in a crisis situation like this to know what steps we can take with the resources that we have that are going to be meaningful ones and make a long-term investment in a better mental health system that includes this hospital and a new hospital and really doesn't just come in and do what I've often heard people say is that these things blow up, committees are created, the problem is dealt with in some fashion, and then people go away, get busy with other things, and move on. And I think our commitment, and I hope I speak for other members of this committee, is not to play a role that is just a temporary one, but to listen to your input and be able to hopefully craft something here that does help move us in the direction that you've described. So I want to thank you very much for being part of this process. Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I think what I'm hearing from this panel, and that I think that this committee is committed to, is keeping people out of the hospital, and when they're in, get them out as quickly as possible, and therefore providing the supports in the community that are going to keep people safe and healthy so that they're going to stay out of the hospital. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Carter.
I'd just like to remind everybody that's in this room tonight that this body has tried, and Senator Gordley has led the fight in terms of raising revenue in this state. There is not enough money in the system as we know it now to pay for the services that we need in this state. And not a lot of people want to open their pocketbooks and raise taxes. Now, that is the plain truth about it all. Even within the resource base that we have now, we have to do a lot more than what we're doing right now, and I just don't see us doing it within the framework of the dollars that we have in the system now. In order to do a more effective job than what we're doing at the state hospital, we're going to need new dollars in the system.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your testimony. And our last panel is Bruce Goldberg, who I believe will be bringing with him James Hargreave and Roy Orr. And we do intend to conclude this hearing by 9 o'clock. So. If not sooner. Thanks for being so patient, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services, co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney, members of the committee, here tonight to do a couple of things. One, to introduce to you two gentlemen who are going to help us be part of the solution to this, and secondly, to just very briefly, given the late hour, give you a sense of some of the budget issues that we've been dealing with the Ways and Means Committee during this legislative session. But first, let me just very briefly preface my introductions of Mr. Orr and Judge Hargreaves by saying that, I think the last panel really, framed the issue quite well for us, which is that I hope what we're doing collectively, what all of us are doing, is not simply addressing a U.S. Department of Justice report, but what we're doing is creating the type of mental health care system which includes our hospital, our community, everything in this state that reflects our values, that allows us to treat people with dignity and provide the excellence of care that I think we all want. And I believe that if we approach this problem with that perspective, that we'll succeed. We really have no other choice. And with that, let me introduce to you two people who can help us with that. Mr. Roy Orr, who we have recently hired as the superintendent of the hospital. He's going to start on Monday, February 25th. We're thrilled that he is joining us and has, I think, the background and experience that we need. You have his resume in front of you. Let him tell you a little bit about himself and then introduce Judge Hargreaves, if that's okay.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. I really didn't prepare any comments. I came to listen, as all of you did. I'm very much impressed by the very thoughtful and thorough comments that have been shared with you tonight from a variety of perspectives.
I'm sorry, I said no protocol, but we do have one that you need to identify yourself.
My name's Roy Orr, and I'm soon to be the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. I currently reside in Eugene, Oregon. And I won't repeat what I already said, but it is a pleasure to have the opportunity to at least become acquainted with this important committee. Clearly, from the comments that are made tonight, people do not want to just continue to spin wheels and continue to study this issue. They're very much interested in long-term change. I personally am very interested in seeing not only a culture change, but a significant perception change of the state hospital as not being the end of a process or the beginning of the end of a process for so many people, but rather part of the continuum of care in this state. And I'm heartened and encouraged by some of the funding that's come out of the legislature to enhance community-based services. Excuse me, to improve discharges from the state hospital. I have quite an orientation ahead of me, as I'm sure you can all relate to now having served for a short period of time on this committee. I'm eager to get underway next week, and my pledge to all of you is to begin to bring to you metrics of change and what is going on in the state hospital and where were we and where are we headed and where are we along that continuum. I think that's what you expect. I think that's what the citizens of Oregon expect. That's certainly what the patients at the state hospital expect. And I think it's in the minds and the hearts of the staff at the state hospital as well. So I thank you very much for this opportunity tonight.
Thank you for being here.
Introduce Judge Hargreaves, and then are there any questions, if that's okay?
Great.
It's also a great opportunity for me tonight to introduce to you Judge Hargreaves, who many of you may know that both the governor and I were looking to engage an individual who could provide some external oversight to our efforts to improve the hospital. As Mr. Orr and individuals within the hospital are working and doing their job within the hospital to make the kind of improvements that we're all looking for, I was looking for the opportunity to have some external oversight to assure that high-quality patient care at the state hospital is achieved, that we meet the recommendations of the Department of Justice report, but as I had indicated previously, that this is really not just about the Department of Justice. This is about improving patient care. We've engaged the judge to be what we're calling a special master to provide oversight, to work with expert consultants, to work with hospital management, to work with patient advocacy groups, hospital administration, patients, families, to have full access to any records, individuals, et cetera, and to report regularly to myself, the governor, as well as to you, and to make him and his oversight and investigation and his findings available to you. I think what this does is allow for all of us to have a degree of what I would call additional external oversight and quality assurance and assuring the accountability of our process. With that, I'd like to turn things over to the judge to introduce himself, and we can open it up for comments.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam co-chairs and members of the committee. I am Jim Hargreaves. I did spend 20 years wearing a black robe in Lane County and was a substantial contributor to the population of the Oregon State Hospital through both the criminal side of the court and through the civil commitment side. I left the court back in 95 and went out into the consulting world and worked for some large consulting companies doing court consulting, and have continued to do that down to the time I recently got a phone call saying, would you consider taking on this job with the Oregon State Hospital? It's probably going to be one of the largest challenges, I think, that I've ever taken on. I look forward to it. I have a very steep learning curve, and I will be doing what I have done over the last 13 or 14 years as a consultant, which is ask an awful lot of questions and ask why not. And there are many, many pieces to this. It's going to take me a while to pull them all together and into some sort of organized approach, but I look forward to it. I think that it will be an opportunity, I think, for someone from really outside of the mental health system to ask maybe the naive questions or bring to bear some thoughts that otherwise may not arise. So I'm face this with a certain amount of trepidation but also eagerness, and I look forward to being a part of this whole improvement project. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Klein.
Two questions. One, is there a changing in the lines of authority for the superintendent or the special master? Is that your term? Your master?
That's not my term, but that's my title.
Yeah, I heard you call that. So that's the first question, is, you know, same lines of authority as before or a difference?
Co-chairs, Representative Clement, be the same lines of authority. You know, this provides external oversight and a degree of impartial oversight, but same lines of authority.
And just the second question is for both of you. I would like to be able to articulate to people who ask the differences and the similarities between what your jobs now are. You know, you're certainly in a new, I mean, I understand the superintendent of the hospital runs it, and you're in a sort of an oversight and respond to the role, but you're also in a very new challenge, and I have to think that responding to the Justice Department report is just as much your situation as it is yours. So how do you two plan to work together, and how do you see your roles, you know, differing?
Co-chairs, Representative Clem, from my perspective as an incoming superintendent, I have a short-term urgency with respect to the DOJ report and even the recent CMS report and some of those regulatory types of issues, and I won't speak for Judge Hargreaves, but my sense is those are almost predominantly his focus coming in. I also take a long-term view. I intend to be the superintendent at Oregon State Hospital for many years, and so I'll balance my short-term urgencies with the fact that my priority will always be, my number one priority will always be patient care. That will never change. I'll have short-term urgencies from time to time, but my number one priority will always be patient care.
Senator Courtney.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think maybe he wanted to answer the.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I don't.
Far be it for me to ignore.
I was thinking
master.
You were asking something of me, and
yes,
and I guess the way I see this is that Mr. Orr, Dr. Goldberg, and all the people that work for him, they're going to be the doers. I'm going to be the watcher, and I may be the one that, as I say, asks the question why and why not, and where are we, how come we're not there,
It's the difference between the doing and the watching, and that's the way I sort of shorthand it.
That's helpful. Thank you.
I guess one, I know I've got other questioners, but one question I would have is, Judge Hargreaves, for how long will you be the special master?
Well, my contract right now is for a year. At the end of that time, I have no idea. If asked to continue, I'm assuming I probably would. But right now, I have a year's contract.
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair. As you know, Dr. Goldberg, we're about to close the session down, and the Ways and Means either start today or tomorrow. We have concluded what the budget we think is going to look like. There is an amount of money because of this crisis we're in. You've been here tonight. You've been here through three meetings. There'll be two allocations, one for money you need right away, and then more money set aside that we'll review in June. It's multi-millions of dollars. Do you, the question is being asked to me, and Council Mickey Logan is here, will the federal government, is this kind of money and what you're going to do with it, are the feds aware of this, and it will us, because, you know, we've given you money before. Is that figure, are those figures that the Ways and Means will take up tomorrow, you still have faith in those figures in terms of what you want to do?
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, we put together a budget request that you have in front of you for $6.7 million,
right,
which is we have faith that this is what we can realistically and appropriately achieve right now as a start to this problem. And we put together a request which represents, I think, the beginning of what is going to be needed. As you heard tonight, this is a complex issue. There are issues, for instance, as you heard tonight, recruitment and retention, ongoing issues about salary restructuring, which are going to need to be dealt with as we move out into the future. What you have before you tonight is a plan that is phased in, that takes into consideration what is available in the labor market right now, that can be implemented, we believe, as rapidly as possible. As an example, we know we have a number of vacancies in areas. To simply add more positions in those areas is not the way to approach the problem. It's to begin to hire those individuals that we believe we can get on board now that can provide some of the help and assistance. We believe that at the Department of Justice, we hope we'll look on this as the kind of appropriate effort that will improve the hospital. We would assume that they are watching what we're doing quite closely and are aware of this budget request. We haven't spoken with them about it, but I think that we're hopeful that they will look at this as the kind of appropriate start at this problem. You have also with this, I think, a series of metrics that we've begun to develop to begin to do exactly what we've talked about tonight, is to look at exactly where we are, and all of these positions are really geared at how we can change those metrics into a way that makes sense.
So, but just not to belabor quickly,
yeah,
you've asked for 1.8 right away?
We've asked for 1.8 right away, and then there is, because we, that is sorry, what it, we can do in the next 4 months,
right,
carried through the rest of the biennium. There is an additional 4.8 million, if my math is correct.
Be considered by the June board.
By the June board, that is there specifically set aside for this, right, and as we need it, we'll be able to come back and request that.
Chair, also, my final question to you going to be is when we're going to meet the next time, when we should meet. So be thinking about that. Mr. Orr, I've heard a lot about you. You're highly regarded in Lane County. in your life, I don't mean to ask you a funny question, but you've been in hospital administration. If you looking at carefully read your vita, you've been in Omaha, Nebraska, you've been in Beaumont, Texas, and of course you've been in Springfield. You've been in a long time.
Right.
You know what you're getting yourself into?
I can tell you after 30 years of experience in the healthcare industry, and more than two-thirds of that, co-chair Courtney, that one never knows until you're actually in. But I have done my homework. I'm not a neophyte at this kind of work. I don't take the opportunity before me lightly. And that's the long-winded answer. The short-winded answer is yes, I do know what I'm in for.
Okay. Your Honor, I am curious. You got a phone call. That phone call come from the governor?
No, sir.
Have you talked to the governor?
No, sir.
Well, then I have to ask you this, because we had a little disagreement with Dr. Goldberg and I as to who should hire you and who should pay you. And and the governor made it very clear to me he was going to hire you and pay you. So that's the way it's working out. But I want to know, because the governor made certain assurances, and since you've yet to talk to him, I'm a little concerned. Your Honor, now I hope this is, you'll respect the question. I'm not trying to cross-examine a judge.
I've had many try.
How much authority or time or discretion do you think you have, even though you're working for the administration, the executive branch, to do this job as the special master?
Well, in terms of time, as I say, I have a contract for a year.
Right.
In terms of authority, I think my authority extends to being able to snoop, if you will, anywhere I want, anytime I want, and reach conclusions, ask questions, make suggestions. I don't believe I am clothed with any authority to make anybody do anything. My authority is to report to Dr. Goldberg, to the governor, and to you, and it's up to those people to make things happen if they think that my ideas or suggestions or observations merit some action that's not being taken.
Have you talked to Council Logan?
No, I just met her this evening. I've been on the job one day. Oh, I'm sorry, 2 days.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to get you, Dr. Goldberg. You are going to talk to the legislature about what you find or what you expect. Is that correct, Special Master, Your Honor?
That's my expectation. My contract calls for me to report to the governor and to Dr. Goldberg. I'm certainly happy to talk to you as well.
Dr. Goldberg was dying to speak to me, so could he be allowed?
Please do so.
Co-Chair Rosenbaum, Co-Chair Courtney, I'm always anxious to talk to you, not dying to talk to you.
And hopefully not dying from that experience either.
I sometimes die after I talk to you, but not to make light of this. I mean, this really isn't. I think what you got at your question was about the authority that the judge has, and I think that authority really is what's vested in myself, and that what I'm looking for in the judge is an individual that can devote their entire effort to the type of oversight that I don't have the physical time to do. I believe, as you indicated at a hearing or two ago, that you couldn't, and indeed none of us could, in essence, embed ourselves full-time within the hospital, that we have multiple responsibilities, and indeed that's Mr. Orr's job is to do the day-to-day operations of that. What I need is to have an individual who has the judgment, the impartiality, the expertise, and the wisdom to, in essence, embed themselves and look at this situation 24/7 and provide the kind of oversight and advice and information to me that ultimately I, through Mr. Orr and Mr. Nickel, need to implement. And that's what we're trying to do. So the judge does not ultimately have the sort of line authority. That's mine and Mr. Orr's. But what this is the authority comes through me.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. I admit, gentlemen, to being a Republican who has a sort of a jaundiced view of terms like special master. Okay. Sounds like some sort of a Zen thing to me. That with no disrespect, Your Honor. Okay. I just want to comment that I think that in front of us we have a judge, a physician, and a hospital administrator. And I think that sort of speaks to what we're dealing with here in the state hospital. And so I think the titles of this team are heartening. Mr. Orr, you said two things that I really wanted to hear. You said metrics of change, and you said two words that we're all sitting here waiting to hear. What are we going to change and how are we going to measure it? And you put it in one phrase and bang, it hits home. And the other thing that you said, long-term view, you're here for the long run. This hospital needs somebody to commit to the long run. I hope you're that person. I hope you can commit, and I hope the hospital can commit to you, because it's a two-way street. Some administrators, going in, you're absolutely right. Some administrators fit with an institution, some don't. And if you aren't that person, I hope you know it soon enough to get somebody else in there. And if you are, I hope that your commitment is long-term, because we need that here. Judge Hargraves, I don't know what your role is here, and I don't know how we're going to measure, you know, your contribution here. I haven't really heard that, but I think that we need some independent eyes, and if that's what you are, I will be anxious to see how this fits together. I certainly some legal eyes and an independent look at things is something. If that's Zen, then so be it. So, thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordley was next.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you for taking on your roles and this assignment. I am surprised to hear, Judge Hargraves, that you've not met with the governor. By news accounts, the governor made the appointment and is giving you a charge. Can you share with us when that meeting will take place? And will you be reporting directly to the governor or to someone else on his staff?
Well, let me back up for just a second and do this really shortly. Mm-hmm. I wasn't privy to all of the way this happened. I got involved because I got a call from the Chief Justice, who told me he got a call from the governor saying that he wanted the chief to give him some suggestions for someone to fill his position. I was one of those. Eventually, I was selected to do that. So in terms of meeting, we are in the process of trying to set up a meeting with the governor. Obviously, he's been rather busy, and I expect that to happen in the next week or two. We are not unknown to each other, so we've known each other for many, many years, not well, but he came out of Lane County, and we've known each other, so we're not a mystery to one another. I do expect to be sitting down with him and getting directly from him his views and his thoughts on this, because I haven't yet had an opportunity to do that. Is that helpful?
It's helpful, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Carter.
I'm glad to see the judge here, because he used to
send patients to the hospital. Now I want to know from the judge, how do you plan to deal with this complicated issue as you watch and snoop and do what you need to do to find out how this complicated system come all together and why the state legislature says we're going to pay you at 39 patients per psychiatrist or wherever, and you end up with 43 people there. And then they come back to the legislature, and the legislature said you overspent your budget. How are you going to deal with that? So when you're snooping, I'm excited because you were on the other end of it that sent us all these extra folks.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with you that there are extra folks, but you know, that's truly this is part of my sort of getting my feet under me. Certainly, the federal report is actually not a bad outline, and I've been sort of working from there, looking at and sort of thinking about this in terms of sort of functional areas just to help me organize all of this, you know. And, you know, I see that, you know, there's a facilities part, there's a staffing part, there's a wages part, there's a training piece for staff, there's medical care. So to me, I sort of have begun in my mind to break it down into some of these categories that touch all of the pieces, and I'm sort of expecting that then I will sort of use that framework to not only watch, but to, as I say, ask a lot of questions. You know, plans are being developed. Looking at these plans in light of this framework, I'm kind of developing in my mind to say, well, you know, does it address these things? Do I think it addresses these things adequately? If not, what do I want to put into this picture? But as I say, this is my second day on the job, and I've got a steep learning curve. And it's going to take me a while to get up to speed, but that's kind of where I'm going.
Well, both of you guys have certainly made me feel hopeful, and I look forward to your work there, and I will be snooping also. So.
Thank you.
Terrific.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to meet you, two gentlemen. Always good to see you, Bruce. But I admit some concern and maybe trepidation here as I look through your resumes that you've given us, and I'm hearing about systems and competitive markets and organizational transformations and consulting and administration and management, data exchange, technology, etc., improving work processes and technology. We're talking about human beings here, very, very vulnerable human beings. And I can understand we're looking at new technology here, and I understand that. We're dealing with human beings, and I want to get that from you too. I want some acknowledgement that we're not dealing with widgets or figures. We're dealing with people here, very, very vulnerable people.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the judge and the new superintendent, welcome to our complicated world. And I'm looking at the resumes and the selection process that went through. I'm sure that I share with all of my colleagues on the dais here that he's in fact selected some very good people to help us, you know, with this. And I think we've heard from people tonight, you know, leaving us a sense of feeling that that working for you at the state hospital are some very good people. And I think as we move up the ladder from the line staff to your positions, I would go through a number of other people, and I think they're all in there, very good people. I think their intentions are certainly the best, and their efforts are certainly the best. But, you know, darn it, in spite of having had very good people, we still have kind of a major problem. And I guess I could say the same thing about all of the folks here, because I think as Senator Carter and Senator Gordley have on a number of occasions where I've been present, God, I don't know that I can do this or not, Senator, but the fingers point both ways, and the legislature certainly shares some responsibility in this. However, having said all of this, we everybody's surrounded with all these good people, but we still have. When I read the Justice Department report, a horrid problem. So it takes something other than just some good people with good intentions here to bring this out. And that kind of, and I'll sum, close with this, Madam Co-Chair, it kind of reminds me of when I first ran for the legislature longer ago than a lot of folks here would like to remember. My wife paraphrased back to me a Mark Twain quote, and I'm wondering if the quote may not apply to the two gentlemen who have just joined us. Supposing you were an idiot. Supposing you were a state legislator. But I repeat myself. It's got to be a tough job, and many of us are going to be, at times, appear to be very critical, and I'm probably going to be one of them. I want us all to make a commitment that this is unacceptable, and that we can solve our problem. Even though Senator Carter is 100% right, we don't have a bottomless pit to go to as far as money. We've got very limited resources, but I think we can make those resources work if we all work together on it. So welcome aboard, and expect to hear from me, understanding that I feel like we're on the same team.
Thank you.
Senator Courtney, did you have a comment? And then I will close the hearing.
Only that we have new leaders, a new team, hopefully new direction. I think we will. I think in a strange way this committee has become part of the new team. Like it or not, and I struggle now because I play a part in this. I don't quite know all of our roles going to be. We're talking about your roles, so I got to figure out this long term. We had three meetings. We wanted to have one of those before the session started because we wanted to do it out at the hospital. We did it. Now we've had two meetings here. Legislature has acted, will act in the next few days for the budget. A lot of effort. A lot of things have happened in just a short period of time, Council. So I assume that the feds know some of the things we're trying to do here, bring about change. The one thing we didn't answer tonight, and I don't want to get into it now because fatigue has started to take a toll. Our next meeting, because I do think we have to allow the new players some period of time, I don't mean a long period of time, to at least get in there, and so that when you tell us, okay, this is a reasonable time, we'll come back to us, because that's critical to know what you think you've found, how things are going. So, Co-Chair, great meeting. You're doing a great job, but I do think we need to get to that next time as to how much time before we meet again, given the fact that the superintendent will be on board next Monday, and the special master is either on board or he will be on board very shortly. And of course, Dr. Goldberg is with us for a long, long time. We've just learned that he's the savior. So, well, mess with me, so.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. I want I actually think this has been a remarkable evening. I know that when Senator Courtney and I were planning this agenda, neither one of us thought that people would be able to sit here for 3 hours. And in fact, it's very clear. I think that the people on this committee are the right people. I think lots of questions have been raised and few have been answered tonight. And so I'm hoping that this is the start of an ongoing, not just discussion, but really a problem-solving process. I want especially to thank the staff who put this hearing together, Sasha Pollack from Senator Courtney's office, Rick Verkovian from Committee Services. I want especially to thank Senator Courtney, whose vision it was that this committee was created. And I just want to thank everybody who came before us tonight, most especially, I think, the people who are working in the hospital, the people who are patients in the hospital, and I think it's remarkable that there are as many people as there are as dedicated to solving this problem. So, with nothing further to come before us this evening.
You just can't imagine the people that's out there and that's in the room there. So a lot more people are here than the people that are in this room.
Thank you, Senator Carter. And nothing further to come before us. We are adjourned.